whole song. If you say so, Jack replies dubiously. His idea of a great rock and roll song is Run Around Sue by Dion. At 16 Robin Hood Lane, that sweet little Cape Cod honey of a home, Fred Marshall is down on his hands and knees, wearing a pair of green rubber gloves, and washing the floor. He's still got Tyler's baseball cap balanced on his head, and he's weeping. Out at the holiday trailer park, the crow Gorg is dripping poison into the porches of Tansy Freneau's ears. In the sturdy brick house on Herman Street, where he lives with the beautiful Sarah and the equally beautiful David, Dale Gilbertson is just getting ready to head back to the office, his movements slightly slowed by two helpings of chicken pot pie and a dish of bread pudding. When the telephone rings, he is not terribly surprised. He's had that feeling, after all. His caller is Debbie Anderson, and from her first word, he knows that something has popped. He listens, nodding, asking an occasional question. His wife stands in the kitchen doorway, watching him with worried eyes. Dale bends and jots on the pad beside the phone. Sarah walks over and reads two names, Andy Railsback and M. Fine. "You still got Railsback on the line?" he asks. "Yes, on hold. Patch me in." "Dale, I don't know if I know how to do that." Debbie sounds uncharacteristically flustered. Dale closes his eyes a moment, reminds himself that this isn't her usual job. "Ernie's not there yet?"
"No."
"Who is?"
"Bobby Dulac. I think Dit might be in the shower."
"Put Bobby on," Dale says, and is relieved when Bobby is able to patch him quickly and painlessly through to Andy Railsback in Morty Fine's office. The two men have been upstairs to room 314, and one look at the Polaroid scattered on the floor of George Potter's closet has been enough for Morty. He's now as pale as Andy himself, maybe paler. Outside the police station, Ernie Terrio and Reginald Doc Amberson meet in the parking lot. Doc has just arrived on his old but perfectly maintained Harley Frat Boy. They exchange amiable greetings in the fog. Ernie Terrio is another cop, sort of, but relax, he's the last one we'll have to meet. Well, there is an FBI agent running around here someplace, but never mind him right now. He's in Madison and he's a fool. Ernie is a trim 65, retired from full-time police duty for almost 12 years, and still four times the cop Arnold Hrabowski will ever be. He supplements his pension by doing night dispatch at the FLPD. He doesn't sleep so well these days, thanks to a cranky prostate, and pulling private security time at First Bank of Wisconsin on Fridays, when the Wells Fargo people come at 2 and the Brinks people at 4. Doc looks every inch the Hell's Angel with his long black and gray beard, which he sometimes braids with ribbons in the style of the pirate Edward Teach, and he brews beer for a living. But the two men get along very well. For one thing, they recognize each other's intelligence. Ernie doesn't know if Doc really is a doctor, but he could be. Maybe at one point he was. "Anything changed?" Doc asks.
"Not that I know of, my friend," Ernie says.
One of the five comes by every night in turn to check. Tonight Doc's got the duty. "Mind if I walk in with you?"
"Nope," Ernie said. "Just as long as you respect the rule."
Doc nods. Some of the other fives can be pissy about the rule, especially Sonny, who's pissy about lots of stuff, but Doc abides by it. One cup of coffee or 5 minutes, whichever comes first, then down the road you go. Ernie, who saw plenty of real Hell's Angels when he was a cop in Phoenix back in the 70s, appreciates how deeply patient Beezer St. Pierre and his crew have been. But of course, they are not Hell's Angels, or pagans, or beasts on bikes, or any of that nonsense. Ernie doesn't know exactly what they are, but he knows that they listen to Beezer, and he suspects that Beezer's patience is growing thin. Ernie knows his would be by now. "Well then, come on in," Ernie says, clapping the big man on the shoulder. "Let's see what's shaking." Quite a lot, as it turns out. Dale finds he is able to think quickly and clearly. His earlier fear has left him, partly because the fuck-up has already happened, and the case, the official case anyway, has been taken away from him. Mostly because he knows he can now call on Jack if he needs to, and Jack will answer. Jack's his safety net. He listens to Railsback's description of the Polaroids,
mostly letting the old fellow vent and settle a bit, and then asks a single question about the two photos of the boy. "Yellow," Railsback replies with no hesitation. "The shirt was yellow. I could read the word Kiwanis on it. Nothing else. The blood." Dale says he understands, and tells Railsback an officer will join them shortly. There is the sound of the phone shifting hands, and then Fine is in his ear, a fellow Dale knows and doesn't much care for.
"What if he comes back, Chief? What if Potter comes back here to the hotel?"
"Can you see the lobby from where you are?"
"No," petulant. "We're in the office. I told you that."
"Then go out front. Look busy.
If he comes in, I don't want to do that. If you'd seen those pictures, you wouldn't want to do it either."
"You don't have to say boo to him," Dale says. "Just call if he goes by."
"But..."
"Hang up the telephone, sir. I've got a lot to do." Sarah has put her hand on her husband's shoulder. Dale puts his free one over hers. There is a click in his ear, loud enough to sound disgruntled.
"Bobby, are you on?"
"Right here, Chief. Debbie, too, and Dit. Oh, and Ernie just walked in."
He lowers his voice.
"He's got one of those motorcycle boys with him, the one who calls himself Doc."
Dale thinks furiously. Ernie, Debbie, Dit, and Bobby, all in uniform. Not good for what he wants. He comes to a sudden decision and says,
"Put the hogger on."
"What?"
"You heard me."
A moment later, he's talking to Doc Amberson. "You want to help bust the fucker who killed Armand St. Pierre's little girl?"
"Hell yes, no hesitation."
"All right. Don't ask questions and don't make me repeat myself."
"I'm listening," Doc says crisply.
"Tell Officer Dulac to give you the blue cell phone in evidence storage. The one we took off the doper who skipped. He'll know the one I mean."
If anyone tries to *69 a call originating from that phone, Dale knows, they won't be able to trace it back to his shop, and that's just as well. He is, after all, supposed to be off the case.
"Blue cell phone. Then walk down to Lucky's Tavern, next to the Nelson Hotel."
"I got my bike."
"No, walk. Go inside, buy a lottery ticket. You'll be looking for a tall man, skinny, salt-and-pepper hair, about 70, khaki pants, maybe a khaki shirt, too. Most likely alone. His favorite roost is between the jukebox and the little hall that goes to the Johns. If he's there, call the station. Just hit 911. Got all that?"
"Yeah."
"Go. Really shuck your buns, Doctor."
Doc doesn't even bother to say goodbye. A moment later, Bobby's back on the phone.
"What are we going to do, Dale?"
"If he's there, we're going to take the son of a bitch," Dale says.
He's still under control, but he can feel his heartbeat accelerating, really starting to crank. The world stands out before him with a brilliance that hasn't been there since the first murder. He can feel every finger of his wife's hand on his shoulder. He can smell her makeup and her hairspray.
"Get Tom Lund and lay out three of the Kevlar vests."
He thinks that over, then says,
"Make it four."
"You're going to call Hollywood?"
"Yeah," he says, "but we're not going to wait for him."
On that, he hangs up. Because he wants to bolt, he makes himself stand still for a moment, takes a deep breath, lets it out, then takes another. Sarah grasps his hands.
"Be careful."
"Oh, yeah," Dale says. "You can take that to the bank." He starts for the door.
"What about Jack?" she calls.
"I'll get him from the car," he says, without slowing. "If God's on our side, we'll have the guy in lockup before he makes it halfway to the station." 5 minutes later, Doc is standing at the bar in Lucky's, listening to Trace Adkins sing "I Left Something Turned On at Home," and scratching a Wisconsin instant winner ticket. It actually is a winner, $10, but most of Doc's attention is focused in the direction of the juke. He bops his shaggy head a little bit, as if he's really getting off on this particular example of shit-kicker deluxe. Sitting at the table in the corner with a plate of spaghetti in front of him, a sauce as red as a nosebleed, and a pitcher of beer close at hand, is the man he's looking for. Tall, even sitting down, skinny, lines grooving his tanned hound dog's face, salt-and-pepper hair neatly combed back. Doc can't really see the shirt because the guy's got a napkin tucked into the collar, but the long leg sticking out from under the table is dressed in khaki. If Doc was entirely sure this was the baby-killing puke who did Amy, he'd make a citizen's arrest right now, an extremely rough one. Fuck the cops and their Miranda shit. But maybe the guy's only a witness or an accomplice or something.
He takes his 10-spot from the bartender, turns down the suggestion that he stay for a beer, and strolls back out into the fog. 10 steps up the hill, he takes the blue cell phone from his pocket and dials 911. This time it's Debbie who answers. "He's there," Doc says. "What next?" "Bring the phone back," she says, and hangs up. "Well, fuck you very much," Doc says mildly. "But he'll be a good boy. He'll play by their rules. Only first..." He dials another number on the blue phone, which has one more chore to do before it passes out of our tail forever, and Bear Girl answers. "Put him on, sweetness," he says, hoping she won't tell him that Beezer's gone down to the sandbar. If the Beez ever goes down there alone, it'll be because he's after one thing, a bad thing. But a moment later, Beezer's voice is in his ear, rough, as if he's been crying. "Yeah, what?" "Round him up and get your heavy-set ass down to the police station parking lot," Doc tells him. "I'm not 100% certain, but I think they might be getting ready to nail the motherfucker done it. I might even have seen Beezer is gone before Doc can get the phone off his ear and push the off button. He stands in the fog, looking up at the bleary lights of the French Landing cop shop, wondering why he didn't tell Beezer and the boys to meet him outside of Lucky's. He supposes he knows the answer. If Beezer got to that old guy before the cops, spaghetti might turn out to be the old guy's last meal. Better to wait, maybe. Wait and see. There's nothing but a fine mist on Herman Street, but the soup thickens almost as soon as Dale turns toward downtown. He turns on his parking lights, but they're not enough. He goes to low beams, then calls Jack's. He hears the recorded announcement start, kills the call, and dials Uncle Henry's. And Uncle Henry answers. In the background, Dale can hear a howling, fuzz-toned guitar and someone growling, "Give me back my dog," over and over. "Yes, he's just arrived," Henry allows. "We're currently in the musical appreciation phase of our evening, literature to follow. We've reached a critical juncture in Bleak House, Chesney Wall, The Ghost's Walk, Mrs. Rouncewell, all of that. And so unless your need is actually urgent, it is. Put him on now, Unc." Henry sighs. "Oui, mon capitaine." A moment later, he's talking to Jack, who of course agrees to come at once. This is good, but French Landing's police chief finds some of his friend's reactions a trifle puzzling. No, Jack doesn't want Dale to hold the arrest until he arrives. Very considerate of him to ask, also very considerate of Dale to have saved him a Kevlar vest, part of the law enforcement booty showered on the FLPD and thousands of other small police departments during the Reagan years. But Jack believes Dale and his men can nab George Potter without much trouble. The truth is, Jack Sawyer seems only slightly interested in George Potter. Ditto the horrific photos, although they must certainly be authentic, rails back as ID Johnny Erkenham's yellow Kiwanis Little League shirt, a detail never given to the press. Even the loathsome Wendell Green never ferreted out that particular fact. What Jack asks about, not once but several times, is the guy Andy Railsback saw in the hallway. "Blue robe, one slipper, and that's all I know," Dale is finally forced to admit. "Jesus, Jack, what does it matter? Listen, I have to get off the telephone." "Ding dong," Jack replies, equably enough, and rings off. Dale turns into the foggy parking lot. He sees Ernie Terrio and the biker brewer called Doc standing outside the back door talking. They are little more than shadows in the drifting fog. Dale's conversation with Jack has left him feeling very uneasy, as if there are huge clues and signposts that he, dullard that he is, has entirely missed. But what clues? For Christ's sake, what signposts? And now a dash of resentment flavors his unease. Perhaps a high-powered Lucas Davenport type like Jack Sawyer just can't believe in the obvious. Perhaps guys like him are always more interested in the dog that doesn't bark. Sound travels well in the fog, and halfway to the station's back door, Dale hears motorcycle engines explode into life down by the river, down on Nail House Row. "Dale," Ernie says. He nods a greeting as if this were any ordinary evening. "Hey, Chief," Doc chips in. He's smoking an unfiltered cigarette and looks to Dale like a Pall Mall or a Chesterfield. Some doctor, Dale thinks. "If I may egregiously misquote Mr. Rogers," Doc goes on, "it's a beautiful night in the neighborhood, wouldn't you say?"
You called them, Dale says, jerking his head in the direction of the revving motorcycles. Two pairs of headlights swing into the parking lot. Dale sees Tom Lund behind the wheel of the first car. The second vehicle is almost certainly Danny Cheetah's personal. The troops are gathering once more. Hopefully this time they can avoid any cataclysmic fuck-ups. They better. This time they could be playing for all the marbles.
Well, I couldn't comment on that directly, Doc says, but I could ask if they were your friends, what would you do?
Same damn thing, Dale says, and goes inside. Henry Layden once more sits primly in the passenger seat of the Ram pickup. Tonight he's dressed in an open-collared white shirt and a pair of trim blue khakis. Slim as a male model, silvering hair combed back. Did Sidney Carton look any cooler going to the guillotine, even in Charles Dickens's mind? Jack doubts it.
Henry, I know, Henry says. Sit here in the truck like a good little boy until I'm called.
With the doors locked. And don't say oui, mon capitaine. That one's wore out.
Will affirmative do?
Nicely. The fog thickens as they near town, and Jack dips his headlights. High beams are no good in this shit. He looks at the dashboard clock, 7:03 p.m. Things are speeding up. He's glad. Do more, think less. Jack Sawyer's recipe for easy care sanity. I'll whisk you inside as soon as they've got Potter jugged.
You don't expect them to have a problem with that, do you?
No, Jack says. Then changes the subject. You know, you surprised me with that Slobberbone record. He can't really call it a song, not when the lead vocalist simply shrieked most of the lyrics at the top of his lungs. That was good.
It's the lead guitar that makes the record, Henry says, picking up on Jack's careful use of the word. Surprisingly sophisticated. Usually the best you can hope for is in tune.
He unrolls his window, sticks his head out like a dog, then pulls it back in. Speaking in that same conversational voice, he says, "The whole town reeks."
It's the fog. It pulls up the river's stinkiest essence.
No, Henry replies, matter-of-factly, it's death. I smell it, and I think you do, too. Only maybe not with your nose.
I smell it, Jack admits. Potter's the wrong man.
I think so.
The man Railsback saw was a Judas goat.
The man Railsback saw was almost certainly the fisherman.
They drive in silence for a while.
Henry?
Affirmative.
What's the best record? The best record and the best song?
Henry thinks about it.
Do you realize what a dreadfully personal question that is?
Yes.
Henry thinks some more, then says,
Stardust, maybe, Hoagy Carmichael.
For you?
The man behind the wheel thinks back, all the way back to when Jackie was 6. His father and Uncle Morgan had been the jazz fiends. His mother had had simpler tastes. He remembers her playing the same song over and over, one endless L.A. summer, sitting and looking out the window and smoking.
Who is that lady, Mom? Jackie asks. And his mother says, Patsy Cline. She died in an airplane crash.
Crazy Arms, Jack says, the Patsy Cline version, written by Ralph Mooney and Chuck Seals.
That's the best record. That's the best song.
Henry says no more for the rest of the drive. Jack is crying. Henry can smell his tears.
Let us now take the wider view, as some politician or other no doubt said. We almost have to, because things have begun to overlap. While Beezer and the rest of the Thunder Five are arriving in the FLPD parking lot just off Sumner Street, Dale and Tom Lund and Bobby Dulac, bulky in their Kevlar vests, are double parking in front of Lucky's. They park in the street because Dale wants plenty of room to swing the back door of the cruiser wide, so that Potter can be bundled in as fast as possible. Next door, Dit Jesperson and Danny Cheetah are at the Nelson Hotel, where they will cordon off room 314 with yellow police line tape. Once that's done, their orders are to bring Andy Railsback and Morty Fine to the police station. Inside the police station, Ernie Terrio is calling WSP officers Brown and Black, who will arrive after the fact. And if they're pissed about that, good deal. At the sandbar, a dead-eyed Tansy Freneau has just pulled the plug on the jukebox, killing the wallflowers.
"Listen to me, everybody," she cries in a voice that's not her own. "They've got him. They've got the baby-murdering son of a bitch. His name's Potter. They'll have him up in Madison by midnight, and unless we do something, some smart lawyer will have him back out on the street by next Monday. Who wants to help me do something about it?"
There is a moment of silence, and then a roar. The half-stoned, half-drunk habitués of the sandbar know exactly what they want to do about it. Jack and Henry, meanwhile, with no fog to slow them down until they hit town, swing into the police station parking lot just behind the Thunder Five, who park in a line around Doc's Fat Boy. The lot is filling up rapidly, mostly with cops' personal vehicles. Word of the impending arrest has spread like fire in dry grass. Inside, one of Dale's crew, we need not bother with exactly which one, spots the blue cell phone Doc used outside Lucky's. This cop grabs it and ducks into the closet-sized room marked evidence storage. At the Oak Tree Inn, where he is checked in for the duration of the fisherman case, Wendell Green is getting sullenly drunk. In spite of 3 double whiskeys, his neck still aches from having his camera pulled off by the biker asshole, and his gut still aches from being sucker-punched by the Hollywood asshole. The parts of him that hurt most of all, however, are his pride and his pocketbook. Sawyer concealed evidence just as sure as shit sticks to a blanket. Wendell is halfway to believing that Sawyer himself is the fisherman, but how can he prove either thing with his film gone? When the bartender says he has a call, Wendell almost tells him to stick the call up his ass. But he's a professional, goddammit, a professional news hawk. And so he goes over to the bar and takes the phone. "Green," he growls. "Hello, asshole," says the cop with the blue cell phone. Wendell doesn't yet know his caller is a cop, only that it's some cheery ghoul poaching on his valuable drinking time. "You want to print some good news for a change?" "Good news doesn't sell papers, my pal." "This will. We caught the guy." "What?" In spite of the 3 doubles, Wendell Green is suddenly the most undrunk man on the planet. "Did I stutter?" The caller is positively gloating, but Wendell Green no longer cares. "We caught the fisherman. Not the Stadies, not the Phoebes, us. Name's George Potter, early 70s, retired builder, had Polaroids of all 3 dead kids. If you hustle, you can maybe be here to snap the picture when Dale takes him inside." This thought, this shining possibility, explodes in Wendell Green's head like a firework. Such a photo could be worth 5 times as much as one of Little Irma's corpse, because the reputable mags would want it. And TV. Also, think of this. What if someone shot the bastard as Marshal Dillon was taking him in? Given the town's mood, it's far from impossible. Wendell has a brief and brilliant memory of Lee Harvey Oswald clutching his stomach, mouth open in his dying yawp. "Who is this?" he blurts. "Officer fucking Friendly," the voice on the other end says, and clicks off. In Lucky's Tavern, Patty Lovelace is now informing those assembled, older than the sandbar crowd and a good deal less interested in non-alcoholic substances, that she can't get no satisfaction and her tractor can't get no traction. George Potter has finished his spaghetti, neatly folded his napkin, which in the end had to catch only a single drop of red sauce, and turned seriously to his beer. Sitting close to the juke as he is, he doesn't notice that the room has quieted with the entrance of 3 men, only one in uniform but all 3 armed, and wearing what looked too much like bulletproof vests to be anything else. "George Potter," someone says, and George looks up. With his glass in one hand and his pitcher of suds in the other, he is a sitting duck. "Yeah, what about it?" he asks, and then he is snatched by the arms and shoulders and yanked from his spot. His knees connect with the bottom of the table, overturning it. The spaghetti plate and the pitcher hit the floor. The plate shatters. The pitcher, made of sterner stuff, does not. A woman screams. A man says, "Yow," in a low and respectful voice. Potter holds on to his partly filled glass for a moment, and then Tom Lund plucks this potential weapon from his hand. A second later, Dale Gilbertson is snapping on the cuffs,
and Dale has time to think that it's the most satisfying sound he's ever heard in his life. His tractor has finally gotten some traction, by God. This deal is light years from the snafu at Ed's. This is slick and tidy. Less than 10 seconds after Dale asked the only question, George Potter, the suspect is out the door and into the fog. Tom has one elbow, Bobby the other. Dale is still rattling off the Miranda warning, sounding like an auctioneer on amphetamines, and George Potter's feet never touch the sidewalk. Jack Sawyer is fully alive for the first time since he was 12 years old, riding back from California in a Lincoln limousine driven by a werewolf. He has an idea that later on he will pay a high price for this regained vividness, but he hopes he will just button his lip and fork over when the time comes, because the rest of his adult life now seems so gray. He stands outside his truck, looking in the window at Henry. The air is dank and already charged with excitement. He can hear the blue-white parking lot lights sizzling like something frying in hot juices. Henry?
Affirmative.
Do you know the hymn Amazing Grace?
Of course I do. Everyone knows Amazing Grace.
Jack says, was blind, but now I see. I understand that now. Henry turns his blind, fearfully intelligent face toward Jack. He is smiling. It is the second sweetest smile Jack has ever seen. The blue ribbon still goes to Wolf, that dear friend of his wandering 12th autumn. Good old Wolf, who liked everything right here and now.
You're back, aren't you?
Standing in the parking lot, our old friend grins.
Jack's back. That's affirmative.
Then go do what you came back to do, Henry says.
I want you to roll up the windows.
And not be able to hear?
I think not, Henry tells him pleasantly enough.
More cops are coming. And this time the blue lights of the lead car are flashing and the siren is blurping. Jack detects a celebratory note to those little blurps and decides he doesn't have time to stand here arguing with Henry about the Ram's windows. He heads for the back door of the police station, and two of the blue-white arcs cast his shadow double on the fog, one dark head north and one south. Part-time officers Holtz and Nestler pull in behind the car bearing Gilbertson, Lund, Dulac, and Potter. We don't care much about Holtz and Nestler. Next in line is Jesperson and Cheetah with Railsback and Morton Fine in the back seat. Morty is complaining about the lack of knee room. We care about Railsback, but he can wait. Next into the lot, oh, this is interesting, if not entirely unexpected. Wendell Green's beat-up red Toyota, with the man himself behind the wheel. Around his neck is his backup camera, a Minolta that'll keep taking pictures as long as Wendell keeps pressing the button. No one from the sandbar, not yet, but there is one more car waiting to turn into the already crowded lot. It's a discreet green Saab, with a police power sticker on the left side of the bumper and one reading Hugs Not Drugs on the right. Behind the wheel of the Saab, looking stunned, but determined to do the right thing, whatever the right thing might be, is Arnold the mad Hungarian Horabowski. Standing in a line against the brick wall of the police station are the Thunder Five. They wear identical denim vests with gold fives on the left breast. Five sets of meaty arms are crossed on five broad chests. Doc, Kaiser Bill, and Sonny wear their hair in thick ponytails. Mouse's is Corn Road tonight. And Beezer's floods down over his shoulders, making him look to Jack a little like Bob Seger in his prime. Earrings twinkle, tats flex on huge biceps.
Armand St. Pierre, Jack says to the one closest the door.
Jack Sawyer. From Ed's? He holds out his hand and isn't exactly surprised when Beezer only looks at it. Jack smiles pleasantly.
You helped big time out there.
Thanks.
Nothing from the bees.
Is there going to be trouble with the intake of the prisoner, do you think?
Jack asks.
He might be asking if Beezer thinks it will shower after midnight.
Beezer watches over Jack's shoulder as Dale, Bobby, and Tom help George Potter from the back of the cruiser and begin walking him briskly toward the back door. Wendell Green raises his camera, then is nearly knocked off his feet by Danny Cheetah, who doesn't even have the pleasure of seeing which asshole he's bumped.
"Watch it, dickweed," Wendell squawks.
Beezer, meanwhile, favors Jack, if that is the word, with a brief, cold glance.
"Well, now," he says, "we'll have to see how it shakes out, won't we?"
"Indeed we will," Jack agrees. He sounds almost happy. He pushes in between Mouse and Kaiser Bill, making himself a place. The Thunder 5 plus 1. And perhaps because they sense he doesn't fear them, the two wide boys make room. Jack crosses his own arms over his chest. If he had a vest, an earring, and a tattoo, he really would fit right in. The prisoner and his custodians kill the distance between the car and the building quickly. Just before they reach it, Beezer St. Pierre, spiritual leader of the Thunder Five and father of Amy, whose liver and tongue were eaten, steps in front of the door. His arms are still folded. In the heartless glare of the parking lot lights, his massive biceps are blue. Bobby and Tom suddenly look like guys with a moderate case of the flu. Dale looks stony, and Jack continues to smile gently, arms placidly crossed, seeming to gaze everywhere and nowhere at once.
"Get out of the way, Beezer," Dale says. "I want to book this man."
And what of George Potter? Is he stunned, resigned, both? It's hard to tell. But when Beezer's bloodshot blue eyes meet Potter's brown ones, Potter does not drop his gaze. Behind him, the looky-loos in the parking lot fall silent. Standing between Danny Cheetah and Dit Jesperson, Andy Railsback and Morty Fine are gawking. Wendell Green raises his camera and then holds his breath like a sniper who's lucked into a shot, just one, mind you, of the commanding general.
"Did you kill my daughter?" Beezer asks. The gentle inquiry is somehow more terrible than any raw yell could have been, and the world seems to hold its breath.
Dale makes no move. In that moment, he seems as frozen as the rest of them. The world waits, and the only sound is a low, mournful hoot from some fog-bound boat on the river.
"Sir, I never killed no one," Potter says.
He speaks softly and without emphasis. Although he has expected nothing else, the words still box Jack's heart. There is an unexpected, painful dignity in them. It's as if George Potter is speaking for all the lost good men of the world. "Stand aside, Beezer," Jack says gently. "You don't want to hurt this guy." And Beezer, looking suddenly not at all sure of himself, does stand aside. Before Dale can get his prisoner moving again, a raucously cheerful voice, it can only be Wendell's, yells out, Hey, fisherman, smile for the camera!" They all look around, not just Potter. They have to. That cry is as insistent as fingernails dragged slowly down a slate blackboard. White light strobes the foggy parking lot. 1, 2, 3, 4, and Dale snarls, fuck me till I cry. Come on, you guys. Jack, I want you. From behind them, one of the other cops calls, Dale, you want me to grab this creep? Leave him alone, Dale shouts and bulls his way inside. It's not until the door is closed behind him and he's in the lower hall with Jack, Tom, and Bobby that Dale realizes how certain he was that Beezer would simply snatch the old man away from him and then crack his neck like a chicken bone.
"Dale?"
Debbie Anderson calls uncertainly from halfway down the stairs. "Is everything all right?" Dale looks at Jack, who still has his arms crossed over his chest and is still smiling his little smile.
"I think it is," Dale says, "for now."
20 minutes later, Jack and Henry, the latter gentleman retrieved from the truck and still reek petite, sit in Dale's office. Beyond the closed door, the ready room roars with conversation and laughter. Almost every cop on the FLPD force is out there, and it sounds like a goddamn New Year's Eve party. There are occasional shouts and smacking sounds that can only be relieved boys and girls in blue high-fiving each other.
In a little while, Dale will put a stop to that shit, but for now he's content to let them go ahead. He understands how they feel, even though he no longer feels that way himself. George Potter has been printed and stuck in a cell upstairs to think things over. Brown and Black of the state police are on their way. For now, that is enough. As for Triumph, well, something about his friend's smile and his faraway eyes have put Triumph on hold. "I didn't think you were going to give Beezer his moment," Jack says. "It's a good thing you did. There might have been trouble right here in River City if you'd tried to face him down." "I suppose I have a better idea tonight of how he feels," Dale replies. "I lost track of my own kid tonight, and it scared the living shit out of me." "David?" Henry cries, leaning forward. "Is David okay?" "Yeah, Uncle Henry, Dave's fine." Dale returns his gaze to the man who now lives in his father's house. He's remembering the first time Jack ever laid eyes on Thornburg Kinderling. Dale had at that point known Jack only 9 days, long enough to form some favorable opinions, but not long enough to realize how really extraordinary Jack Sawyer was. That was the day Jenna Massengale at the taproom told Jack about the trick Kinderling did when he was getting squiffy. That little trick of pinching his nostrils shut with his palm turned out to the world. They had just arrived back at the police station from interviewing Jenna, Dale in his personal unit that day, and he had touched Jack on the shoulder just as Jack was about to get out of the car. "Speak a name, see the face it belongs to before supper time. That's what my mother used to say." He pointed down to 2nd Street, where a broad-shouldered, bald fellow had just come out of News and Notions, a newspaper under his arm and a fresh deck of smokes in his hand. "That's Thornburg Kinderling, his very own self." Jack had bent forward without speaking, looking with the sharpest and perhaps the most merciless eyes Dale had ever seen in his life. "Do you want to approach him?" Dale had asked. "No, hush." And Jack simply sat with one leg in Dale's car and one out of it, not moving, eyes narrowed. So far as Dale could tell, he didn't even breathe. Jack watched Kinderling open his cigarettes, tap one out, put it in his mouth, and light it. He watched Kinderling glance at the headline of the Herald and then saunter to his own car, an all-wheel drive Subaru. Watched him get in, watched him drive away. And by that time, Dale realized he was holding his own breath. "Well," he'd asked when the Kinderling mobile was gone, "what do you think?" And Jack had said, "I think he's the guy." Only Dale had known better. Even then, he had known better. Jack was saying, "I think," only because he and Chief Dale Gilbertson of French Landing, Wisconsin, were still on short terms, getting to know you, getting to work with you terms. What he had meant was, "I know." And although that was impossible, Dale had quite believed him. Now, sitting in his office with Jack directly across the desk from him, his reluctant but scarily gifted deputy, Dale asks, "What do you think? Did he do it?" "Come on, Dale, how can I—" "Don't waste my time, Jack, because those assholes from WSP are going to be here any minute, and they'll take Potter hi-ho over the hills. You knew it was Kinderling the second you looked at him, and you were halfway down the block. You were close enough to Potter when I brought him in to count the hairs in his nose. So what do you think?" Jack is quick, at least, spares him the suspense and just administers the chop. "No," he says, "not Potter. Potter's not the fisherman." Dale has known that Jack believes this, knew it from his face outside, but hearing it is still an unhappy thump. He sits back, disappointed. "Deduction or intuition?" Henry asks. "Both," Jack says. "And stop looking like I plugged your mother, Dale. You may still have the key to this thing. Rails back?" Jack makes a seesawing gesture with one hand. "Maybe, maybe not," it says. Railsback probably saw what the fisherman wanted him to see. Although the single slipper is intriguing, and I want to ask Railsback about it. But if Mr. One Slipper was the fisherman, why would he lead Railsback and us to Potter? "To get us off his trail," Dale says. "Oh, have we been on it?"
Jack asks politely. And when neither of them answers, but say he thinks we're on his trail. I can almost buy that, especially if he just remembered some goof he might have made.
Nothing back yet on the 7-Eleven phone, one way or the other, if that's what you're thinking of, Dale tells him.
Jack appears to ignore this. His eyes gaze off into the middle distance. That little smile is back on his face. Dale looks at Henry and sees Henry looking at Jack. Unc's smile is easier to read, relief and delight. Look at that, Dale thinks. He's doing what he was built to do. By God, even a blind man can see it. Why Potter? Jack finally repeats. Why not one of the Thunder Five, or the Hindu at the 7-Eleven, or Artist Walker down at the bait shop? Why not Reverend Hovla? What motive usually surfaces when you uncover a frame job? Dale thinks it over.
Payback, he says at last. Revenge.
In the ready room, a phone rings.
Shut up, shut up, Ernie bellows to the others. Let's try to act professional here for 30 seconds or so.
Jack, meanwhile, is nodding at Dale. I think I need to question Potter, and rather closely.
Dale looks alarmed. Then you better get on it right away, before Brown and Black...
He comes to a halt, frowning, with his head cocked. A rumbling sound has impinged on his attention. It's low, but rising.
Uncle Henry, what's that?
Motors, Henry says promptly. A lot of them.
They're east of here, but coming this way, edge of town.
And I don't know if you've noticed this, but it sounds like the party next door is, like, over, dude. As if this were a cue, Ernie Terrio's distressed cry comes through the door.
Oh, shit!
Dit Jesperson.
What's Ernie? Get the chief! Ah, never mind, I'll...
There is a single perfunctory knock, and then Ernie's looking in at the brain trust. He's as collected and soldierly as ever, but his cheeks have paled considerably beneath his summer tan, and a vein is pulsing in the middle of his forehead.
Chief, I just took a call on the 911. 20 was the sandbar?
That hole, Dale mutters.
Caller was the bartender. It says about 50 to 70 people are on their way.
By now, the sound of approaching engines is very loud. It sounds to Henry like the Indy 500, just before the pace car runs for dear life and the checkered flag drops.
Don't tell me, Dale says. What do I need to make my day complete? Let me think. They're coming to take my prisoner.
Yes, sir, that's what the caller said, Ernie agrees. Behind him, the other cops are silent. In that moment, they don't look like cops at all to Dale. They look like nothing but dismayed faces, crudely drawn in a dozen or so white balloons. Also two black ones, can't forget Pam Stevens and Bob Holtz. The sound of the engines continues to grow.
Also might want to know one other thing the caller said.
Christ, what?
Said the,
Ernie searches for a word that isn't mob.
The protest group was being led by the Freneau girl's mom?
Oh, my Christ, Dale says. He gives Jack a look of sick panic and utter frustration. The look of a man who knows he is dreaming, but can't seem to wake up no matter how hard he tries.
If I lose Potter, Jack, French Landing is going to be the lead story on CNN tomorrow morning.
Jack opens his mouth to reply, and the cell phone in his pocket picks that moment to start up its annoying tweet. Henry Layden immediately crosses his arms and tucks his hands into his armpits.
Don't hand it to me, he says. Cell phones give you cancer. We agreed on that.
Dale, meanwhile, has left the room. As Jack digs for the cell phone, thinking someone has picked a cataclysmically shitty time to ask him about his network television preferences, Henry follows his nephew, walking briskly, with his hands now held slightly out, fingers gently fluttering the air, seeming to read the currents for obstacles. Jack hears Dale saying that if he sees a single drawn weapon, the person who drew it will join Arnie Hrabrowski on the suspension list. Jack is thinking exactly one thing. No one is taking Potter anywhere until Jack Sawyer has had time to put a few pointed questions. No way. He flicks the cell phone open and says, "Not now, whoever you are. We've got hidey-ho, traveling Jack," says the voice from the phone. And for Jack Sawyer, the years once more roll away.
Speedy? The very one, Speedy says. Then the drawl is gone. The voice becomes brisk and businesslike.
And as one coppersman to another, son, I think you ought to visit Chief Gilbertson's private bathroom right now.
Outside, there are enough vehicles arriving to shake the building. Jack has had a bad feeling about this, has since he heard Ernie say who was leading the Fool's Parade.
Speedy, I don't exactly have the time to visit the facilities right now.
You haven't got time to visit any place else, Speedy replies coldly.
Only now he's the other one, the hard boy named Parkus.
What you're going to find there you can use twice. But if you don't use it almighty quick the first time, you won't need it the second time, because that man is going to be up a lamppost.
And just like that, Speedy is gone. When Tansy leads the willing patrons into the sandbar's parking lot, there is none of the carnival raucousness that was the keynote of the clusterfuck at Ed's Eats and Dogs. Although most of the folks we met at Ed's have been spending the evening in the bar getting moderately to seriously tanked, they are quiet, even funereal, as they follow Tansy out and fire up their cars and pickups. But it's a savage funerality. She has taken something in from Gorg, some stone-powerful poison, and passed it along to them. In the belt of her slacks is a single crow feather. Doodle Sanger takes her arm and guides her sweetly to Teddy Runkleman's International Harvester pickup. When Tansy heads for the truck bed, which already holds two men and one hefty female in a white rayon waitress's uniform, Doodle steers her toward the cab.
"No, honey," Doodle says, "you sit up there. Be comfy."
Doodles wants that last place in the truck bed. She spotted something and knows just what to do with it. Doodles is quick with her hands. Always has been. The fog isn't thick this far from the river, but after 24 cars and trucks have spun out of the bar's dirt parking lot, following Teddy Runkleman's dented one taillight IH, you can barely see the tavern. Inside, only half a dozen people are left. These were somehow immune to Tansy's eerily powerful voice. One of them is Stinky Cheese, the bartender. Stinky has a lot of liquid assets to protect out here and isn't going anywhere. When he calls 911 and speaks to Ernie Terrio, it will be mostly in the spirit of petulance. If he can't go along and enjoy the fun, by God, at least he can spoil it for the rest of those monkeys. 20 vehicles leave the sandbar. By the time the caravan passes Ed's Eats, the lane leading to it cordoned off by yellow tape, and the no trespassing sign alongside the overgrown lane to that queer forgotten house, not cordoned off, not even noticed for that matter, the caravan has grown to 30. There are 50 cars and trucks rolling down both lanes of Route 35 by the time the mob reaches Gultz's. And by the time it passes the 7-Eleven, there must be 80 vehicles or more, and maybe 250 people. Credit this unnaturally rapid swelling to the ubiquitous cell phone. Teddy Runkleman, oddly silent, he is in fact afraid of the pallid woman sitting beside him, her snarling mouth and her wide, unblinking eyes, brings his old truck to a halt in front of the FLPD parking lot entrance. Sumner Street is steep here, and he sets the parking brake. The other vehicles halt behind him, filling the street from side to side, rumbling through rusty mufflers and blatting through broken exhaust pipes. Misaligned headlights stab the fog like searchlight beams at a movie premiere. The night's dank, wet fish smell has been overlaid with odors of burning gas, boiling oil, and cooking clutch lining. After a moment, doors begin to open and then clap shut. But there is no conversation, no yelling, no indecorous yee-haw whooping, not tonight. The newcomers stand in clusters around the vehicles that brought them, watching as the people in the back of Teddy's truck either jump over the sides or slip off the end of the tailgate, watching as Teddy crosses to the passenger door, at this moment as attentive as a young man arriving with his date at the junior prom, watching as he helps down the slim young woman who has lost her daughter. The mist seems to outline her somehow and give her a bizarre electric aura, the same blue of the sodium lights on Beezer's upper arm. The crowd gives out a collective and weirdly amorous sigh when it sees her. She is what connects them.
All her life, Tansy Freneau has been the forgotten one. Even Cubby Freneau forgot her eventually, running off to Green Bay and leaving her here to work odd jobs and collect the ADC. Only Irma remembered her. Only Irma cared. And now Irma is dead. Not here to see unless she's looking down from heaven, Tansy thinks in some distant and ever-receding part of her mind, her mother suddenly idolized. Tansy Freneau has tonight become the dearest subject of French Landing's eye and heart, not its mind, because its mind is temporarily gone, perhaps in search of its conscience, but certainly of its eye and heart, yes. And now, as delicately as the girl she once was, Doodle Sanger approaches this woman of the hour. What Doodle spotted lying on the floor of Teddy's trunk bed was an old length of rope, dirty and oily, but thick enough to do the trick. Below Doodle's petite fist hangs the noose that her clever hands have fashioned on the ride into town. She hands it to Tansy, who holds it up in the misty light. The crowd lets out another sigh. Noose raised, looking like a female Diogenes in search of an honest man rather than for a cannibal in need of lynching, Tansy walks, delicate herself in her jeans and blood-stained sweatshirt, into the parking lot. Teddy, Doodles, and Freddy Sacknessum walk behind her, and behind them come the rest. They move toward the police station like the tide. The Thunder Five are still standing with their backs to the brick wall and their arms folded.
"What the fuck do we do?" Mouse asks.
"I don't know about you," Beezer says, "but I'm going to stand here until they grab me, which they probably will." He's looking at the woman with the upraised noose. He's a big boy, and he's been in a lot of hard corners, but this chick frightens him with her blank, wide eyes, like the eyes of a statue. And there's something stuck in her belt, something black. Is it a knife? Some kind of dagger? "And I'm not going to fight because it won't work."
"They'll lock the door, right?" Doc asks nervously. "I mean, the cops will lock the door."
"I imagine," Beezer says, never taking his eyes from Tansy Freneau. "But if these folks want Potter, they'll have him on the half shell. Look at him, for Christ's sake. There's a couple of hundred." Tansy stops, the noose still held up.
"Bring him out," she says.
Her voice is louder than it should be, as if some doctor has cunningly hidden an amplifying gadget in her throat.
"Bring him out! Give us the killer!"
Doodles joins in.
"Bring him out!"
And Teddy.
"Give us the killer!"
And Freddy.
"Bring him out! Give us the killer!"
And then the rest. It could be almost the soundtrack of George Rathbun's Badger Barrage, only instead of "Block That Kick" or "On Wisconsin," they are screaming, "Bring him out! Give us the killer!"
"They're gonna take him," Beezer murmurs.
He turns to his troops, his eyes both fierce and frightened. Sweat stands out on his broad forehead in large, perfect drops.
"When she's got him pumped up to high, she'll come and they'll be right on her ass. Don't run, don't even unfold your arms, and when they grab you, let it happen. If you want to see daylight tomorrow, let it happen."
The crowd stands knee-deep in fog like spoiled skim milk, chanting, "Bring him out! Give us the killer!" Wendell Green is chanting right along with them, but that doesn't keep him from continuing to take pictures. Because, shit, this is the story of a lifetime. From the door behind Beezer, there's a click. "Yeah, they locked it," he thinks. "Thanks, you whores." But it's the latch, not the lock. The door opens. Jack Sawyer steps out. He walks past Beezer without looking or reacting as Beez mutters, "Hey, man, I wouldn't go near her." Jack advances slowly but not hesitantly into the no man's land between the building and the mob with the woman standing at its head. Lady Liberty with the upraised hangman's noose instead of a torch in her hand. In his simple gray collarless shirt and dark pants, Jack looks like a cavalier from some old romantic tale advancing to propose marriage. The flowers he holds in his own hand add to this impression. These tiny white blooms are what Speedy left for him beside the sink in Dale's bathroom.
a cluster of impossibly fragrant white blossoms. They are lilies of the Vale, and they are from the territories. Speedy left him no explanation about how to use them, but Jack needs none. The crowd falls silent. Only Tansy, lost in the world Gorg has made for her, continues to chant, "Bring him out! Give us the killer!" She doesn't stop until Jack is directly in front of her, and he doesn't kid himself that it's his handsome face or dashing figure that ends the too loud repetition. It is the smell of the flowers, their sweet and vibrant smell, the exact opposite of the meaty stench that hung over Ed's eats. Her eyes clear, a little at least. "Bring him out," she says to Jack. Almost a question. "No," he says, and the word is filled with heartbreaking tenderness. "No, dear." Behind them, Doodle Sanger suddenly thinks of her father for the first time in maybe 20 years and begins to weep. "Bring him out," Tansy pleads. Now her own eyes are filling. "Bring out the monster who killed my pretty baby." "If I had him, maybe I would," Jack says. "Maybe I would at that, although he knows better. But the guy we've got's not the guy you want. He's not the one." "But Gorg said..." "Here is a word he knows. One of the words Judy Marshall tried to eat. Jack, not in the territories, but not entirely in this world right now either, reaches forward and plucks the feather from her belt. "Did Gorg give you this?"
"Yes."
Jack lets it drop, then steps on it. For a moment he thinks, knows, that he feels it buzzing angrily beneath the sole of his shoe, like a half-crushed wasp. Then it stills. Gorg lies, Tansy. Whatever Gorg is, he lies. The man in there is not the one. Tansy lets out a great wail and drops the rope. Behind her, the crowd sighs. Jack puts his arm around her, and again he thinks of George Potter's painful dignity. He thinks of all the lost, struggling along without a single clean territory's dawn to light their way. He hugs her to him, smelling sweat and grief and madness and coffee brandy. In her ear, Jack whispers, "I'll catch him for you, Tansy." She stiffens.
"You..."
"Yes."
"You promise?"
"Yes."
"He's not the one?"
"No, dear."
"You swear?"
Jack hands her the lilies and says, "On my mother's name." She lowers her nose to the flowers and inhales deeply. When her head comes up again, Jack sees that the danger has left her, but not the insanity. She's one of the lost ones now. Something has gotten to her. Maybe if the fisherman is caught, it will leave her. Jack would like to believe that. "Someone needs to take this lady home," Jack says. He speaks in a mild, conversational voice, but it still carries to the crowd. She's very tired and full of sadness.
"I'll do it," Doodle says.
Her cheeks gleam with tears. "I'll take her in Teddy's truck, and if he don't give me the keys, I'll knock him down. And that's when the chant starts again, this time from back in the crowd. "Bring him out! Give us the killer! Give us the fisherman! Bring out the fisherman!" For a moment it's a solo job, and then a few other hesitant voices begin to join in and lend harmony. Still standing with his back against the bricks, Beezer St. Pierre says, "Shit, here we go again." Jack forbade Dale to come out into the parking lot with him, saying that the sight of Dale's uniform might set off the crowd. He didn't mention the little bouquet of flowers he was holding, and Dale barely noticed them. He was too terrified of losing Potter to Wisconsin's first lynching in 200 years. He followed Jack downstairs, however, and has now commandeered the peephole in the door by right of seniority. The rest of the FLPD is still upstairs, looking out of the ready room windows. Henry has ordered Bobby Dulac to give him a running play-by-play. Even in his current state of worry about Jack, Henry thinks there's at least a 40% chance the mob will either trample him or tear him apart, Henry is amused and flattered to realize that Bobby is doing George Rathbun without even realizing it.
Okay, Hollywood's out there. He approaches the woman. No sign of fear. The rest of them are quiet. Jack and the woman appear to be talking, and holy Jesus, he's given her a bouquet of flowers. What a ploy!
Ploy is one of George Rathbun's favorite sports terms, as in the Brew Crew's hit-and-run ploy failed yet again last night at Miller Park.
She's turning away, Bobby yells jubilantly. He grabs Henry's shoulder and shakes it. Hot damn, I think it's over. I think Jack turned her off.
Even a blind man could see he turned her off, Henry says.
Just in time, too, Bobby says. Here's Channel 5, and there's another truck with one of those big orange poles on it. Fox Milwaukee, I think.
Bring him out, a voice outside begins yelling. It sounds cheated and indignant.
Give us the killer! Give us the fisherman!
Oh, no, Bobby says, even now sounding like George Rathbun, telling his morning-after audience how another Badger rally had started to fizzle.
Not now, not with the TV here. That's... Bring out the fisherman!
Henry already knows who that is. Even through two layers of chicken wire-reinforced glass, that high yapping cry is impossible to mistake. Wendell Green understands his job. Don't ever make the mistake of thinking he doesn't. His job is to report the news, to analyze the news, to sometimes photojournalize the news. His job is not to make the news. But tonight he can't help it. This is the second time in the last 12 hours that a career maker of a story has been extended to his grasping, pleading hands, only to be snatched away at the last second.
Bring him out!
Wendell bawls. The raw strength in his voice surprises, then thrills him.
Give us the killer! Give us the fisherman!
The sound of other voices joining in with his provides an incredible rush. It is, as his old college roommate used to say, a real zipper buster. Wendell takes a step forward, his chest swelling, his cheeks reddening, his confidence building. He's vaguely aware that the Action News 5 truck is rolling slowly toward him through the crowd. Soon there will be 10Ks and 5Ks shining through the fog. Soon there will be TV cameras rolling tape by their harsh light. So what? If the woman in the blood-spattered sweatshirt was in the end too chicken to stand up for her own kid, Wendell will do it for her. Wendell Green, shining exemplar of civic responsibility. Wendell Green, leader of the people. He begins to pump his camera up and down. It's exhilarating, like being back in college at a Skynyrd concert, stoned. It's like there is a huge flash in front of Wendell Green's eyes. Then the lights go out. All of them.
Arnie hit him with his flashlight!
Bobby is screaming. He grabs Dale's blind uncle by the shoulders and whirls him in a delirious circle. A thick aroma of aqua velva descends toward Henry, who knows Bobby's going to kiss him on both cheeks French style a second before Bobby actually does this. And when Bobby's narration resumes, he sounds as transported as George Rathbun on those rare occasions when the local sports teams actually buck the odds and grab the gold.
Can you believe it? The mad Hungarian hit him with his ever-loving flashlight, and Green's down! The fucking Hungarian has put everyone's favorite asshole reporter on the mat! Way to go, Hrabowski!
All around them, cops are cheering at the tops of their lungs. Debbie Anderson starts chanting, "We are the champions," and other voices quickly lend support. These are strange days in French Landing, Henry thinks. He stands with his hands in his pockets, smiling, listening to the bedlam. There's no lie in the smile. He's happy, but he's also uneasy in his heart, afraid for Jack. Afraid for all of them, really.
That was good work, man, Beezer tells Jack. I mean balls to the wall.
Jack nods.
Thanks. I'm not going to ask you again if that was the guy. You say he's not, he's not. But anything we can do to help you find the right one, you just call us.
The other members of the Thunder Five rumble assent. Kaiser Bill gives Jack a friendly bop on the shoulder. It will probably leave a bruise.
Thanks, Jack says again.
Before he can knock on the door, it's opened. Dale grabs him and gives him a crushing embrace. When their chests touch, Jack can feel Dale's heart beating hard and fast.
You saved my ass, Dale says into his ear. Anything I can do, you can do something, all right, Jack says, pulling him inside.
I saw another cop car behind the news trucks. Couldn't tell for sure, but I think this one was blue.
Uh-oh, Dale says.
Uh-oh is right. I need at least 20 minutes with Potter. It might not get us anything, but it might get us a lot. Can you hold off Brown and Black for 20 minutes?
Dale gives his friend a grim little smile.
I'll see you get half an hour, minimum.
That's great. And the 911 tape of the fisherman's call, do you still have that?
It went with the rest of the evidence we were holding after Brown and Black took the case. A trooper picked it up this afternoon.
Dale, no.
Easy, big boy. I've got a cassette copy safe in my desk.
Jack pats his chest. Don't scare me that way.
Sorry, Dale says, thinking seeing you out there, I wouldn't have guessed you were afraid of anything.
Halfway up the stairs, Jack remembers Speedy telling him he could use what had been left in the bathroom twice, but he has given the flowers to Tansy for now. Shit. Then he cups his hands over his nose, inhales, and smiles. Maybe he still has them after all.
Chapter 17.
George Potter is sitting on the bunk in the third holding cell down a short corridor that smells of piss and disinfectant. He's looking out the window at the parking lot, which has lately been the scene of so much excitement, and which is still full of milling people. He doesn't turn at the sound of Jack's approaching footfalls. As he walks, Jack passes two signs. One call means one call, reads the first. AA meetings Monday at 7 p.m., NA meetings Thursday at 8 p.m., reads the second. There's a dusty drinking fountain and an ancient fire extinguisher, which some wit has labeled laughing gas. Jack reaches the bars of the cell and raps on one with his house key. Potter at last turns away from the window. Jack, still in that state of hyper-awareness that he now recognizes as a kind of territorial residue, knows the essential truth of the man at a single look. It's in the sunken eyes and the dark hollows beneath them. It's in the sallow cheeks and the slightly hollowed temples with their delicate nestles of veins. It's in the too sharp prominence of the nose.
"Hello, Mr. Potter," he says. "I want to talk to you, and we have to make it fast."
"They wanted me," Potter remarks.
"Yes.
Maybe you should have let him take me. Another 3-4 months, I'm out of the race anyway."
In his breast pocket is the mag card Dale has given him, and Jack uses it to unlock the cell door. There's a harsh buzzing as it trundles back on its short track. When Jack removes the key, the buzzing stops. Downstairs in the ready room, an amber light marked HC3 will now be glowing. Jack comes in and sits down on the end of the bunk. He has put his key ring away, not wanting the metallic smell to corrupt the scent of lilies.
"Where have you got it?"
Without asking how Jack knows, Potter raises one large, gnarled hand, a carpenter's hand, and touches his midsection. Then he lets it drop.
"Started in the gut. That was 5 years ago. I took the pills and the shots like a good boy. La Riviere, that was. That stuff. Man, I was throwing up everywhere. Corners and just about everywhere. Once I threw up in my own bed and didn't even know it. Woke up the next morning with puke drying on my chest. You know anything about that, son?"
"My mother had cancer," Jack says quietly, "when I was 12. Then it went away."
"She get 5 years?
More."
"Lucky," Potter says. "Got her in the end, though, didn't it?"
Jack nods. Potter nods back. They're not quite friends yet, but it's edging that way. It's how Jack works, always has been.
"That shit gets in and waits," Potter tells him. "My theory is that it never goes away, not really. Anyway, shots is done. Pills is done, too. Except for the ones that kill the pain. I come here for the finish."
"Why?" This is not a thing Jack needs to know, and time is short. But it's his technique, and he won't abandon what works just because there are a couple of state police jarheads downstairs waiting to take his boy. Dale will have to hold them off, that's all.
Seems like a nice enough little town. And I like the river. I go down every day. I like to watch the sun on the water. Sometimes I think of all the jobs I did. Wisconsin, Minnesota, Illinois. And then sometimes I don't think about much of anything. Sometimes I just sit there on the bank and feel at peace.
What was your line of work, Mr. Potter?
Started out as a carpenter, just like Jesus. Progressed to builder, and then got too big for my britches. When that happens to a builder, he usually goes around calling himself a contractor. I made $3-4 million out of Cadillac, had a young woman who hauled my ashes Friday nights. Nice young woman, no trouble. Then I lost it all. Only thing I missed was the Cadillac. It had a smoother ride than the woman. Then I got my bad news and come here.
He looks at Jack.
You know what I think sometimes? That French Landing's close to a better world. One where things look and smell better. Maybe where people act better. I don't go around with folks. I'm not a friendly type person, but that doesn't mean I don't feel things. I got this idea in my head that it's not too late to be decent. You think I'm crazy?
No, Jack tells him. That's pretty much why I came here myself. I'll tell you how it is for me. You know how if you put a thin blanket over a window, the sun will still shine through? George Potter looks at him with eyes that are suddenly alight. Jack doesn't even have to finish the thought, which is good. He has found the wavelength. He almost always does. It's his gift. And now it's time to get down to business.
You do know, Potter says simply.
Jack nods. You know why you're here?
They think I killed that lady's kid.
Potter nods toward the window.
The one out there that was holding up the noose. I didn't. That's what I know.
Okay, that's a start. Listen to me now. Very quickly, Jack lays out the chain of events that has brought Potter to this cell. Potter's brow furrows as Jack speaks, and his big hands knot together.
Rail's back, he says at last. I should have known. Nosy, goddamn old man, always asking questions, always asking, do you want to play cards or maybe shoot some pool or, I don't know, play Parcheesi, for Christ's sake. Also, he can ask questions, goddamn nosy Parker.
There's more in this vein, and Jack lets him go on with it for a while. Cancer or no cancer, this old fellow has been ripped out of his ordinary routine without much mercy and needs to vent a little. If Jack cuts him off to save time, he'll lose it instead. It's hard to be patient. How is Dale holding those two assholes off? Jack doesn't even want to know. But patience is necessary. When Potter begins to widen the scope of his attack, however, Morty Fine comes in for some abuse, as does Andy Railsback's pal Irv Thronberry. Jack steps in. The point is, Mr. Potter, that Railsback followed someone to your room. No, that's the wrong way to put it. Railsback was led to your room. Potter doesn't reply, just sits looking at his hands. But he nods. He's old, he's sick and getting sicker, but he's four counties over from stupid. The person who led Railsback was almost certainly the same person who left the Polaroids of the dead children in your closet.
Yeah, makes sense. And if he had pictures of the dead kitties, he was probably the one who made him dead.
Right. So I have to wonder. Potter waves an impatient hand.
I guess I know what you got to wonder. Who there is around these parts who'd like to see Chicago Potsy strung up by the neck? Or the balls?
Exactly.
Don't want to put a stick in your spokes, sonny, but I can't think of nobody.
No? Jack raises his eyebrows. Never did business around here? Built a house or laid out a golf course? Potter raises his head and gives Jack an impatient look.
Course I did.
How else do you think I knew how nice it is, especially in the summer? You know the part of town they call Libertyville? Got all those ye olde streets like Camelot and Avalon?
Jack nods.
I built half of those, back in the 70s. There was a fella around then, some moke I knew from Chicago, or thought I knew. Was he in the business?
This last seems to be Potter addressing Potter.
In any case, he gives his head a brief shake. Can't remember. Doesn't matter anyway. How could it? Fella was getting on then. Must be dead now. It was a long time ago.
But Jack, who interrogates as Jerry Lee Lewis once played the piano, thinks it does matter. In the usually dim section of his mind where intuition keeps its headquarters, lights are coming on. Not a lot yet, but maybe more than just a few.
A moke, he says, as if he has never heard the word before.
What's that?
Potter gives him a brief, irritated look. A citizen who... Well, not exactly a citizen. Someone who knows people who are connected. Or maybe sometimes connected people call him. Maybe they do each other favors. A moke. It's not the world's best thing to be.
No, Jack thinks. But moking can get you a Cadillac with that nice smooth ride.
Were you ever a moke, George?
Gotta get a little more intimate now. This is not a question Jack can address to a Mr. Potter.
Maybe, Potter says after a grudging, considering pause. Maybe I was. Back in Chi. In Chi, you had to scratch backs and wet beaks if you wanted to land the big contract. I don't know how it is there now, but in those days, a clean contractor was a poor contractor, you know.
Jack nods.
The biggest deal I ever made was a housing development on the south side of Chicago. Just like in that song about bad, bad Leroy Brown.
Potter chuckles rustily. For a moment he's not thinking about cancer or false accusations or almost being lynched. He's living in the past. And it may be a little sleazy, but it's better than the present. The bunk chained to the wall, the steel toilet, the cancer spreading through his guts.
Man, that one was big. I kid you not. Lots of federal money. But the local hotshots decided where the dough went home at night. And me and this other guy, this moke, we were in a horse race.
He breaks off, looking at Jack with wide eyes.
Holy shit. What are you, magic?
I don't know what you mean. I'm just sitting here.
That guy was the guy who showed up here. That was the moke.
I'm not following you, George. But Jack thinks he is, and although he's starting to get excited, he shows it no more than he did when the bartender told him about Kinderling's little nose-pinching trick.
It's probably nothing, Potter says. Guy had plenty of reasons not to like yours truly, but he's got to be dead. He'd be in his 80s, for Christ's sake.
Tell me about him, Jack says.
He was a moke, Potter repeats, as if this explains everything. And he must have gotten trouble in Chicago, or somewhere around Chicago, because when he showed up here, I'm pretty sure he was using a different name.
When did you swink him on the housing development deal, George? Potter smiles, and something about the size of his teeth and the way they seem to jut from the gums allows Jack to see how fast death is rushing toward this man. He feels a little shiver of goose flesh, but he returns the smile easily enough. This is also how he works.
If we're gonna talk about moking and swinking, you better call me Potsy.
All right, Potsy. When did you swink this guy in Chicago?
That much is easy, Potter says. It was summer when the bids went out. But the hot shots were still bellering about how the hippies came to town the year before and gave the cops and the mayor a black eye. So I'd say 1969. What happened was I'd done the building commissioner a big favor, and I'd done another for this old woman who swung weight on this special equal opportunity housing commission that Mayor Daley had set up. So when the bids went out, mine got special consideration. This other guy, the moke, I have no doubt that his bid was lower. He knew his way around, and he must have had his own contacts, but that time I had the inside track.
He smiles. The gruesome teeth appear, then disappear again.
Moke's bid?
Somehow gets lost. Comes in too late. Bad luck. Chicago Potsy nails the job. Then, 4 years later, the moke shows up here, bidding on the Libertyville job. Only that time, when I beat him, everything was square John. I pulled no strings. I met him in the bar at the Nelson Hotel the night after the contract was awarded, just by accident. And he says, "You were that guy in Chicago." And I say, "There are lots of guys in Chicago." Now, this guy was a moke, but he was a scary moke. He had a kind of smell about him. I can't put it any better than that. Anyway, I was big and strong in those days. I could be mean, but I was pretty meek that time. Even after a drink or two, I was pretty meek. "Yeah," he says, "there are a lot of guys in Chicago, but only one who diddled me. I still got a sore ass from that Potsy, and I got a long memory. Any other time, any other guy, I might have asked how good his memory stayed after he got his head knocked on the floor. But with him, I just took it. No more words passed between us. He walked out. I don't think I ever saw him again. But I heard about him from time to time while I was working the Libertyville job, mostly from my subs. Seems like the moke was building a house of his own in French Landing for his retirement. Not that he was old enough to retire back then, but he was getting up a little. 50s, I'd say, and that was in 72. He was building a house here in town, Jack muses. Yeah. It had a name, too, like one of those English houses, the Birches, Lake House, Beardsley Manor, you know. What name? Shit. I can't even remember the moke's name. I'd expect me to remember the name of the house he built. But one thing I do remember. None of the subs liked it. It got a reputation.
Bad?
The worst. There were accidents. One guy cut his hand clean off on a bandsaw, almost bled to death before they got him to the hospital. Another guy fell off a scaffolding and ended up paralyzed. What they call a quad, you know what that is?
Jack nods.
Only house I ever heard of people were calling haunted even before it was all the way built. I got the idea that he had to finish most of it himself.
What else did they say about this place? Jack puts the question idly, as if he doesn't care much one way or the other. But he cares a lot. He has never heard of a so-called haunted house in French Landing. He knows he hasn't been here anywhere near long enough to hear all the tales and legends. But something like this? You'd think something like this would pop out of the deck early.
Ah, man. I can't remember. Just that...
He pauses, eyes distant. Outside the cell, the crowd is finally beginning to disperse. Jack wonders how Dale is doing with Brown and Black. The time seems to be racing, and he hasn't gotten what he needs from Potter. What he's gotten so far is just enough to tantalize.
"One guy told me the sun never shone there even when it shone," Potter says abruptly. "He said the house was a little way off the road, in a clearing, and it should have gotten sun at least 5 hours a day in the summer, but it somehow didn't. He said the guys lost their shadows, just like in a fairy tale, and they didn't like it. And sometimes they heard a dog growling in the woods. Sounded like a big one. A mean one. But they never saw it. You know how it is, I imagine. Stories get started, and then they just kind of feed on themselves."
Potter's shoulders suddenly slump. His head lowers.
"Man, that's all I can remember.
What was the moke's name when he was in Chicago?"
"Can't remember."
Jack suddenly thrusts his open hands under Potter's nose. With his head lowered, Potter doesn't see them until they're right there, and he recoils, gasping. He gets a noseful of the dying smell on Jack's skin.
"What? Jesus, what's that?"
Potter seizes one of Jack's hands and sniffs again, greedily.
"Boy, that's nice. What is it?"
"Lilies," Jack says, but it's not what he thinks. What he thinks is the memory of my mother. What was the moke's name when he was in Chicago?
"It... something like Bierstein. That's not it, but it's close. Best I can do."
"Bierstein," Jack says. And what was his name when he got to French Landing 3 years later? Suddenly there are loud, arguing voices on the stairs.
I don't care, someone shouts.
Jack thinks it's Black, the more officious one.
It's our case, he's our prisoner, and we're taking him out now.
Dale,
I'm not arguing, I'm just saying that the paperwork, Brown, oh, fuck the paperwork, we'll take it with us.
What was his name in French Landing, Potsy?
I can't.
Potsy takes Jack's hands again. Potsy's own hands are dry and cold. He smells Jack's palms, eyes closed. On the long exhale of his breath, he says,
Burnside. Chummy Burnside. Not that he was chummy. The nickname was a joke. I think his real handle might have been Charlie.
Jack takes his hands back. Charles Chummy Burnside, once known as Beer Stein, or something like Beer Stein. And the house. What was the name of the house? Brown and Black are coming down the corridor now, with Dale scurrying after them. There's no time, Jack thinks. Damn it all, if I had even 5 minutes more. And then Potsy says,
Black House. I don't know if that's what he called it or what the subs working the job got to calling it, but that was the name, all right.
Jack's eyes widen. The image of Henry Layden's cozy living room crosses his mind, sitting with a drink at his elbow and reading about Jarndyce and Jarndyce. Did you say Bleak House?
Black, Potsy reiterates impatiently, because it really was.
It was, oh dear to Christ, one of the state troopers says in a snotty look with the cat dragged in voice that makes Jack feel like rearranging his face. It's Brown, but when Jack glances up, it's Brown's partner he looks at. The coincidence of the other trooper's name makes Jack smile.
Hello, boys, Jack says, getting up from the bunk.
What are you doing here, Hollywood? Black asks. Just batting the breeze and waiting for you, Jack says, and smiles brilliantly.
I suppose you want this guy.
You're goddamn right, Brown growls, and if you fucked up our case,
gosh, I don't think so, Jack says.
It's a struggle, but he manages to achieve a tone of amiability. Then, to Potsy, you'll be safer with them than here in French Landing, sir. George Potter looks vacant again, resigned.
Don't matter much either way, he says, then smiles as a thought occurs to him. If old Chummy's still alive and you run across him, you might ask him if his ass still hurts from that diddling I gave him back in 69. And tell him old Chicago Potsy says hello.
What the hell are you talking about? Brown asks, glowering. He has his cuffs out and is clearly itching to snap them on George Potter's wrists.
Old times, Jack says.
He stuffs his fragrant hands in his pockets and leaves the cell. He smiles at Brown and Black. Nothing to concern you boys. Trooper Black turns to Dale.
You're out of this case, he says. Those are words of one syllable. I can't make it any simpler.
So tell me once and mean it forever, Chief. Do you understand?
Of course I do, Dale said. Take the case and welcome. But get off the tall white horse, will you? If you expect me to simply stand by and let a crowd of drunks from the sandbar take this man out of Lucky's and lynch him.
Don't make yourself look any stupider than you already are, Brown snaps. They picked his name up off your police calls.
I doubt that. Dale says, quietly, thinking of the doper's cell phone borrowed out of evidence storage.
Black grabs Potter's narrow shoulder, gives it a vicious twist, then thrusts him so hard toward the door at the end of the corridor that the man almost falls down. Potter recovers, his haggard face full of pain and dignity.
Troopers, Jack says.
He doesn't speak loudly or angrily, but they both turn. Abuse that prisoner one more time in my sight, and I'll be on the phone to the Madison Shoe Fly Pies the minute you leave, and believe me, troopers, they will listen to me. Your attitude is arrogant, coercive, and counterproductive to the resolution of this case. Your interdepartmental cooperation skills are non-existent. Your demeanor is unprofessional and reflects badly upon the state of Wisconsin. You will either behave yourselves, or I guarantee you that by next Friday, you will be looking for security jobs. Although his voice remains even throughout, Black and Brown seem to shrink as he speaks. By the time he finishes, they look like a pair of chastened children. Dale is gazing at Jack with awe. Only Potter seems unaffected. He's gazing down at his cuffed hands with eyes that could be 1,000 miles away. "Go on now," Jack says. "Take your prisoner, take your case records, and get lost." Black opens his mouth to speak, then shuts it again. They leave. When the door closes behind them, Dale looks at Jack and says very softly, "Wow."
"What?"
"If you don't know," Dale says, "I'm not going to tell you." Jack shrugs. Potter will keep them occupied, which frees us up to do a little actual work. If there's a bright side to tonight, that's it. "What did you get from him? Anything?" "A name. Might mean nothing. Charles Burnside, nicknamed Chummy. Ever heard of him?" Dale sticks out his lower lip and pulls it thoughtfully. Then he lets go and shakes his head. "The name itself seems to ring a faint bell. But that might only be because it's so common. The nickname, no. He was a builder, a contractor, a wheeler dealer in Chicago over 30 years ago, according to Potsy at least."
"Potsy?" Dale says.
The tape is peeling off a corner of the "one call means one call" sign, and Dale smooths it back down with the air of a man who doesn't really know what he's doing.
"You and he got pretty chummy, didn't you?"
"No," Jack says. "Burnside's chummy. And Trooper Black doesn't own the Black House."
"You've gone dotty. What Black House?"
"First, it's a proper name. Black, capital B, House, capital H. Black House. You ever heard of a house named that around here?"
Dale laughs. "God, no."
Jack smiles back. But all at once it's his interrogation smile, not his "I'm discussing things with my friend" smile. Because he's a coppiceman now, and he has seen a funny little flicker in Dale Gilbertson's eyes.
"Are you sure?"
"Take a minute, think about it."
"Told you no. People don't name their houses in these parts. Oh, I guess old Miss Graham and Miss Pentel call their place on the other side of the town library Honeysuckle because of the honeysuckle bushes all over the fence in front. But that's the only one in these parts I ever heard named."
Again, Jack sees that flicker. Potter is the one who will be charged for murder by the Wisconsin State Police. But Jack didn't see that deep flicker in Potter's eyes a single time during their interview because Potter was straight with him. Dale isn't being straight. "But I have to be gentle with him," Jack tells himself, "because he doesn't know he's not being straight." How is that possible? As if in answer, he hears Chicago Potsy's voice.
"One guy told me the sun never shone there even when it shone. He said the guys lost their shadows, just like in a fairy tale."
Memory is a shadow. Any cop trying to reconstruct a crime or an accident from the conflicting accounts of eyewitnesses knows it well. Is Potsy's Black House like this? Something that casts no shadow? Dale's response, he has now turned full face to the peeling poster, working on it as seriously as he might work on a heart attack victim in the street, administering CPR right out of the manual until the ambulance arrives, suggests to Jack that it might be something like just that. 3 days ago, he wouldn't have allowed himself to consider such an idea. But 3 days ago, he hadn't returned to the territories. According to Potsy, this place got a reputation as a haunted house, even before it was completely built, Jack says, pressing a little.
"Nope."
Dale moves on to the sign about the AA and NA meetings. He examines the tape studiously, not looking at Jack.
"Doesn't ring the old chimeroo."
"Sure. One man almost bled to death. Another took a fall that paralyzed him. People complained." "Listen to this, Dale. It's good. According to Potsy, people complained about losing their shadows. Couldn't see them even at midday with the sun shining full force. Isn't that something?"
"Sure is. But I don't remember any stories like that."
As Jack walks toward Dale, Dale moves away. Almost scutters away. Although Chief Gilbertson is not ordinarily a scuttering man. It's a little funny. A little sad. A little horrible. He doesn't know he's doing it. Jack's sure of that. There is a shadow. Jack sees it, and on some level, Dale knows he sees it. If Jack should force him too hard, Dale would have to see it too, and Dale doesn't want that. Because it's a bad shadow. Is it worse than a monster who kills children and then eats selected portions of their bodies? Apparently, part of Dale thinks so. I could make him see that shadow, Jack thinks coldly. Put my hands under his nose, my lily-scented hands, and make him see it. Part of him even wants to see it. The coppiceman part. Then another part of Jack's mind speaks up in the Speedy Parker drawl he now remembers from his childhood.
You could push him over the edge of a nervous breakdown, too, Jack. God knows he's close to one. After all the goings-on since the Erkenham boy got took, you want to chance that? And for what? He didn't know the name. About that, he was being straight.
Dale? Dale gives Jack a quick, bright glance, then looks away. The furtive quality in that quick peek sort of breaks Jack's heart.
What?
Let's go get a cup of coffee. At this change of subject, Dale's face fills with glad relief. He claps Jack on the shoulder.
Good idea.
God-pounding good idea right here and now, Jack thinks, then smiles. There's more than one way to skin a cat, and more than one way to find a black house. It's been a long day, best maybe to let this go, at least for tonight.
What about Railsback? Dale asks as they clatter down the stairs. You still want to talk to him?
You bet, Jack replies, heartily enough. But he holds out little hope for Andy Railsback, a picked witness who saw exactly what the fisherman wanted him to see. With one little exception, perhaps. The single slipper. Jack doesn't know if it will ever come to anything, but it might. In court, for instance, as an identifying link. This is never going to court, and you know it. It may not even finish in this His thoughts are broken by a wave of cheerful sound as they step into the combination ready room and dispatch center. The members of the French Landing Police Department are standing and applauding. Henry Layden is also standing and applauding. Dale joins in.
Jesus, guys, quit it, Jack says, laughing and blushing at the same time.
But he won't lie to himself, try to tell himself he takes no pleasure in that round of applause. He feels the warmth of them, can see the light of their regard. Those things aren't important. But it feels like coming home, and that is. When Jack and Henry step out of the police station an hour or so later, Beezer, Mouse, and Kaiser Bill are still there. The other two have gone back to the row to fill in the various old ladies on tonight's events.
Sawyer, Beezer says.
Yes, Jack says.
Anything we can do, man. Can you dig that? Anything.
Jack looks at the biker thoughtfully, wondering what his story is, other than grief, that is.
A father's grief.
Beezer's eyes remain steady on his. A little off to one side, Henry Layden stands with his head raised to smell the river fog, humming deep down in his throat.
I'm going to look in on Irma's mom tomorrow around 11, Jack says.
Do you suppose you and your friends could meet me in the sandbar around noon? She lives close to there, I understand. I'll buy you a round of lemonade.
Beezer doesn't smile, but his eyes warm up slightly.
We'll be there.
That's good, Jack says. Mind telling me why?
There's a place that needs finding.
Does it have to do with whoever killed Amy and the other kids?
Maybe. Beezer nods.
Maybe's good enough.
Jack drives back toward Norway Valley slowly, and not just because of the fog. Although it's still early in the evening, he is tired to the bone and has an idea that Henry feels the same way. Not because he's quiet. Jack has become used to Henry's occasional dormant stretches. No, it's the quiet in the truck itself. Under ordinary circumstances, Henry is a restless, compulsive radio tuner, running through the La Riviere stations, checking KDCU here in town, then ranging outward, hunting for Milwaukee, Chicago, maybe even Omaha, Denver, and St. Louis if conditions are right. An appetizer of bop here, a salad of spiritual music there, perhaps a dash of Perry Como way down at the foot of the dial. Hot diggity dog, diggity boom, what you do to me? Not tonight, though. Tonight, Henry just sits quiet on his side of the truck with his hands folded in his lap. At last, when they're no more than 2 miles from his driveway, Henry says, "No Dickens tonight, Jack. I'm going straight to bed." The weariness in Henry's voice startles Jack, makes him uneasy. Henry doesn't sound like himself, or any of his radio personae. At this moment, he just sounds old and tired, on the way to being used up. "I am too," Jack agrees, trying not to let his concern show in his voice. Henry picks up on every vocal nuance. He's eerie that way. "What do you have in mind for the Thunder Five, may I ask?" "I'm not entirely sure," Jack says. And perhaps because he's tired, he gets this untruth past Henry. He intends to start Beezer and his buddies looking for the place Potsy told him about, the place where shadows had a way of disappearing. At least, way back in the 70s they did. He had also intended to ask Henry if he's ever heard of a French Landing domicile called Black House. Not now, though. Not after hearing how beat Henry sounds. Tomorrow, maybe. Almost certainly, in fact, because Henry is too good a resource not to use. Best to let him recycle a little first, though. "You have the tape, right?" Henry pulls the cassette with the fisherman's 911 call on it partway out of his breast pocket, then puts it back. "Yes, Mother, but I don't think I can listen to a killer of small children tonight, Jack. Not even if you come in and listen with me." "Tomorrow will be fine," Jack says, hoping he isn't condemning another of French Landing's children to death by saying this. "You're not entirely sure of that." "No," Jack agrees. "But you listening to that tape with dull ears could do more harm than good. I am sure of that. First thing in the morning, I promise." Henry's house is up ahead now. It looks lonely with only the one light on over the garage, but of course Henry doesn't need lights inside to find his way. "Henry, are you going to be all right?" "Yes," Henry says. But to Jack he doesn't seem entirely sure. "No rat tonight," Jack tells him firmly. "No." Ditto the shake, the shook, the chic. Henry's lips lift in a small smile. Not even a George Rathbun promo for French Landing Chevrolet where price is king and you never pay a dime of interest for the first 6 months with approved credit. Straight to bed. "Me too," Jack says. But an hour after lying down and putting out the lamp on his bedside table, Jack is still unable to sleep. Faces and voices revolve in his mind like crazy clock hands, or a carousel on a deserted midway. Tansy Freneau, bring out the monster who killed my pretty baby. Beezer St. Pierre, we'll have to see how it shakes out, won't we? George Potter, that shit gets in and waits. My theory is that it never goes away, not really. Speedy, a voice from the distant past on the sort of telephone that was science fiction when Jack first met him.
Hi-de-ho, traveling Jack, as one coppersman to another, son. I think you ought to visit Chief Gilbertson's private bathroom right now.
As one coppersman to another, right. And most of all, over and over again, Judy Marshall. You don't just say, "I'm lost and I don't know how to get back." You keep on going. Yes, but keep on going where? Where? At last he gets up and goes out onto the porch with his pillow under his arm. The night is warm. In Norway Valley, where the fog was thin to begin with, the last remnants have now disappeared, blown away by a soft east wind. Jack hesitates, then goes on down the steps, naked except for his underwear. The porch is no good to him, though. It's where he found that hellish box with the sugar packet stamps. He walks past his truck, past the Bird Hotel, and into the north field. Above him are a billion stars. Crickets hum softly in the grass. His fleeing path through the hay and timothy has disappeared. Or maybe now he's entering the field in a different place. A little way in, he lies down on his back, puts the pillow under his head, and looks up at the stars. Just for a little while, he thinks. Just until all those ghost voices empty out of my head. Just for a little while. Thinking this, he begins to drowse. Thinking this, he goes over. Above his head, the pattern of the stars changes. He sees the new constellations form. What is that one, where the Big Dipper was a moment before? Is it the sacred Apopanax? Perhaps it is. He hears a low, pleasant, creaking sound, and knows it's the windmill he saw when he flipped just this morning, 1,000 years ago. He doesn't need to look at it to be sure, any more than he needs to look at where his house was and see that it has once more become a barn. Creak, creak, creak. Vast wooden vanes turning in that same east wind. Only now the wind is infinitely sweeter, infinitely purer. Jack touches the waistband of his underpants and feels some rough weave. No jockey shorts in this world. His pillow has changed, too. Foam has become goose down, but it's still comfortable. More comfortable than ever, in truth. Sweet under his head. I'll catch him, Speedy, Jack Sawyer whispers up at the new shapes in the new stars. At least I'll try. He sleeps. When he awakens, it's early morning. The breeze is gone. In the direction from which it came, there's a bright orange line on the horizon. The sun is on its way. He's stiff, and his ass hurts, and he's damp with dew, but he's rested. The steady, rhythmic creaking is gone, but that doesn't surprise him. He knew from the moment he opened his eyes that he's in Wisconsin again. And he knows something else. He can go back any time he wants. The real coolie country, the deep coolie country, is just a wish and a motion away. This fills him with joy and dread in equal parts. Jack gets up and barefoots back to the house with his pillow under his arm. He guesses it's about 5 in the morning. Another 3 hours sleep will make him ready for anything. On the porch steps, he touches the cotton of his jockey shorts. Although his skin is damp, the shorts are almost dry. Of course they are. For most of the hours he spent sleeping rough, as he spent so many nights that autumn when he was 12, they weren't on him at all. They were somewhere else. In the land of Apopanax, Jack says, and goes inside. 3 minutes later, he's asleep again, in his own bed. When he wakes, at 8, with the sensible sun streaming in through his window, he could almost believe that his latest journey was a dream. But in his heart, he knows better. Chapter 18. Remember those news vans that drove into the parking lot behind the police station? And Wendell Green's contribution to the excitement before Officer Hrabowski's giant flashlight knocked him into the land of Nod. Once the crews inside the vans took in the seeming inevitability of a riot, we can be sure they rose to the occasion. For the next morning, their footage of the wild night dominates television screens across the state. By 9 o'clock, people in Racine and Milwaukee, people in Madison and Delafield, and people who live so far north in the state that they need satellite dishes to get any television at all, are looking up from their pancakes, their bowls of Special K, their fried eggs and their buttered English muffins, to watch a small, nervous-looking policeman finishing off a large, florid reporter's budding career as a demagogue by clocking him with a blunt instrument. And we may also be sure of one other matter. That nowhere is this footage watched as widely and compulsively as in French Landing and the neighboring communities of Centralia and Arden.
Thinking about several matters at once, Jack Sawyer watches it all on a little portable TV placed on his kitchen counter. He hopes that Dale Gilbertson will not revoke Arnold Hrabowski's suspension, although he strongly suspects that the mad Hungarian will soon be back in uniform. Dale only thinks he wants him off the force for good. He is too soft-hearted to listen to Arnie's pleas. And after last night, even a blind man can see that Arnie is going to plead, without relenting. Jack also hopes that the awful Wendell Green will get fired or move away in disgrace. Reporters are not supposed to thrust themselves into their stories, and here is good old loudmouth Wendell baying for blood like a werewolf. However, Jack has the depressing feeling that Wendell Green will talk his way out of his present difficulties, that is, lie his way out of them, and go on being a powerful nuisance. And Jack is pondering Andy Railsback's description of the creepy old man trying the doorknobs on the third floor of the Nelson Hotel. There he was, the fisherman, given form at last. An old man in a blue robe and one slipper striped black and yellow like a bumblebee. Andy Railsback had wondered if this unpleasant-looking old party had wandered away from the Maxton Elder Care Facility. That was an interesting notion, Jack thought. If Chummy Burnside is the man who planted the photographs in George Potter's room, Maxton's would be a perfect hidey-hole for him. Wendell Green is watching the news on the Sony in his hotel room. He cannot take his eyes off the screen, although what he sees there afflicts him with a mixture of feelings, anger, shame, and humiliation that makes his stomach boil. The knot on his head throbs, and every time he witnesses that poor excuse for a cop sneaking up behind him with his flashlight raised, he pushes his fingers into the thick, curly hair at the back of his head and gently palpates it. The damn thing feels about the size of a ripe tomato and just as ready to burst. He's lucky not to have a concussion. That pipsqueak could have killed him. Okay, maybe he went a little bit over the edge. Maybe he took a tiny step across a professional boundary. He never claimed to be perfect. The local news guys, they piss him off, all that guff about Jack Sawyer. Who is the top guy covering the fisherman story? Who has been all over it from day one, telling the citizens what they need to know? Who's been putting himself on the line day after crummy goddamn day? Who gave the guy his name? Not those blow-dried airheads, Bucky and Stacy, those wannabe news reporters and local anchors who smile into the camera to show off their capped teeth, that's for sure. Wendell Green is a legend around here, a star, the closest thing to a giant of journalism ever to come out of western Wisconsin. Even over in Madison, the name Wendell Green stands for, well, unquestioned excellence. And if the name Wendell Green is like the gold standard now, just wait until he rides the fisherman's blood-spattered shoulders all the way to a Pulitzer Prize. So tomorrow morning, Sunday, he has to go into the office and pacify his editor. Big deal. It isn't the first time and it won't be the last. Good reporters make waves. Nobody admits it, but that's the deal. That's the fine print nobody reads until it's too late. When he walks into his editor's office, he knows what he's going to say. Biggest story of the day, and did you see any other reporters there? And when he has the editor eating out of his hand again, which will take about 10 minutes flat, he intends to drop in on a Goltz's salesman named Fred Marshall. One of Wendell's most valuable sources has suggested that Mr. Marshall has some interesting information about his special, special baby, the fisherman case. Arnold Hrabowski, now a hero to his darling wife Paula, is watching the news in a post-coital glow and thinking that she is right. He really should call Chief Gilbertson and ask to be taken off suspension. Wondering with half his mind where he might look for George Potter's old adversary, Dale Gilbertson watches Bucky and Stacy cut away yet again to the spectacle of the mad Hungarian taking care of Wendell Green, and thinks that he really should reinstate the little guy. Would you look at the beautiful swing Arnie took? Dale can't help it. That swing really brightens up his day. It's like watching Mark McGuire, like watching Tiger Woods. Alone in her dark little house off the highway, Wanda Kinderling, to whom we have made passing mention from time to time, is listening to the radio. Why is she listening to the radio?
Some months ago, she had to decide between paying her cable bill and buying another half-gallon of Aristocrat vodka. And sorry, Bucky and Stacy, but Wanda followed her bliss. She went with her heart. Without cable service, her television set brings in little more than snow and a heavy dark line that scrolls up over her screen in an endless loop. Wanda always hated Bucky and Stacy anyhow, along with almost everyone else on television, especially if they looked content and well-groomed. She has a special loathing for the hosts of morning news programs and network anchors. Wanda has not been content or well-groomed since her husband, Thorny, was accused of terrible crimes he could never, ever have committed by that high and mighty show-off Jack Sawyer. Jack Sawyer ruined her life, and Wanda is not about to forgive or forget. That man trapped her husband. He set him up. He smeared Thorny's innocent name and packed him off to jail just to make himself look good. Wanda hopes they never catch the fishermen, because the fishermen is exactly what they deserve, those dirty bastards. Play dirty, you are dirty, and people like that can go straight to the deepest bowels of hell. That's what Wanda Kinderling thinks. The fisherman is retribution. That's what Wanda thinks. Let him kill 100 brats, let him kill 1,000, and after that he can start in on their parents. Thorny could not have killed those sluts down there in Los Angeles. Those were sex murders, and Thorny had no interest in sex, thank the Lord. The rest of him grew up, but his man part never did. His thingy was about the size of his little finger. It was impossible for him to care about nasty women and sex things. But Jack Sawyer lived in Los Angeles, didn't he? So why couldn't he have killed those sluts, those whores, and blamed it all on Thorny? The newscaster describes former Lieutenant Sawyer's actions of the previous night, and Wanda Kinderling spits up bile, grabs the glass from her bedside table, and douses the fire in her guts with 3 inches of vodka. Gorg, who would seem a natural visitor to the likes of Wanda, pays no attention to the news, for he is far away in Faraway. In his bed at Maxton's, Charles Burnside is enjoying dreams not precisely his, for they emanate from another being, from elsewhere, and depict a world he has never seen on his own. Ragged, enslaved children plod on their bleeding footsies past leaping flames, turning giant wheels that turn yet larger wheels, oh-ho, aha, that power the beautiful engines of destruction, mounting, mounting to the black and red sky. The big combination. An acrid stink of molten metal and something truly vile, something like dragon urine, perfumes the air, as does the leaden stench of despair. Scarlet demons with thick, flickering tails whip the children along. A din of clattering and banging, of crashing and enormous thuds punishes the ears. These are the dreams of Bernie's dearest friend and loving master, Mr. Munshun, a being of endless and perverse delight. Down past the end of Daisy Wing, across the handsome lobby, and through Rebecca Vilas's little cubicle, Chipper Maxton is concerned with matters considerably more mundane. The little TV on a shelf over the safe broadcasts the wondrous image of mad Hungarian Hrabowski clobbering Wendell Green with a nice clean sweep of his heavy-duty flashlight, but Chipper barely notices the splendid moment. He has to come up with the $13,000 he owes his bookie, and he has only about half of that sum. Yesterday, lovely Rebecca drove to Monroe to withdraw most of what he had stashed there, and he can use about $2,000 from his own account as long as he replaces it before the end of the month. That leaves about $6,000, an amount that will call for some seriously creative bookkeeping. Fortunately, creative bookkeeping is a specialty of Chipper's, and when he begins to think of his options, he sees his current difficulty as an opportunity. After all, he went into business in the first place to steal as much money as possible, didn't he? Apart from being serviced by Miss Vilas, stealing is about the only activity that makes him truly happy. The amount is almost irrelevant, As we have seen, Chipper derives as much pleasure from conning chump change out of the visiting relatives after the Strawberry Fest as from screwing the government out of $10,000 or $15,000. The thrill lies in getting away with it. So he needs $6,000. Why not take $10,000? That way he can leave his own account untouched and still have an extra $2,000 to play with. He has 2 sets of books on his computer, and he can easily draw the money from the company's bank account without setting off bells during his next state audit, which is coming up in about a month. Unless the auditors demand the bank records, and even then there are a couple of tricks he can use. It's too bad about the audit, though. Chipper would like to have a little more time to paper over the cracks. Losing the $13,000 wasn't the problem, he thinks. The problem was that he lost it at the wrong time. In order to keep everything clear in his head, Chipper pulls his keyboard toward him and tells the computer to print out complete statements of both sets of books for the past month. By the time the auditors show up, baby, those pages will have been fed into the shredder and come out as macaroni. Let us move from one form of insanity to another. After the owner of the Holiday Trailer Park has extended a trembling index finger to point out the Freneau residence, Jack drives toward it on the dusty path with gathering doubts. Tansy's Airstream is the last and least maintained of a row of 4. 2 of the others have flowers in a bright border around them, and the 3rd has been dressed up with striped green awnings that make it look more like a house. The 4th trailer displays no signs of decoration or improvement. Dying flowers and skimpy weeds straggle in the beaten earth surrounding it. The shades are pulled down. An air of misery and waste hangs about it, along with a quality Jack might define, if he stopped to consider it, as slippage. In no obvious way, the trailer looks wrong. Unhappiness has distorted it, as it can distort a person. And when Jack gets out of his truck and walks toward the cinder blocks placed before the entrance, his doubts increase. He can no longer be sure why he has come to this place. It occurs to Jack that he can give Tansy Freneau nothing but his pity, and this thought makes him uneasy. Then it occurs to him that these doubts mask his real feelings, which have to do with the discomfort the trailer arouses in him. He does not want to enter that thing. Everything else is a rationalization. He has no choice but to keep moving forward. His eyes find the welcome mat, a reassuring touch of the ordinary world he can feel already disappearing around him. And he steps up onto the topmost board and knocks on the door. Nothing happens. Maybe she really is still asleep and would prefer to stay that way. If he were Tansy, he would stay in bed as long as possible. If he were Tansy, he'd stay in bed for weeks. Once more, pushing away his reluctance, Jack raps on the door again and says, "Tansy, are you up?" A little voice from within says, "Up where?" "Uh-oh," Jack thinks, and says, "Out of bed. I'm Jack Sawyer, Tansy. We met last night. I'm helping the police, and I told you I'd come over today." He hears footsteps moving toward the door.
"Are you the man who gave me the flowers? He was a nice man."
"That was me." A lock clicks, and the knob revolves. The door cracks open. A sliver of a faintly olive-skinned face and a single eye shine out of the inner darkness.
"It is you. Come in fast. Fast."
She steps back, opening the door just wide enough for him to pass through. As soon as he is inside, she slams it shut and locks it again. The molten light burning at the edges of the curtains and the window shades deepens the darkness of the long trailer's interior. One soft lamp burns above the sink, and another, just as low, illuminates a little table otherwise occupied by a bottle of coffee brandy, a smeary glass decorated with a picture of a cartoon character, and a scrapbook. The circle of light cast by the lamp extends to take in half of a low, fabric-covered chair next to the table. Tansy Freneau pushes herself off the door and takes two light, delicate steps toward him. She tilts her head and folds her hands together beneath her chin. The eager, slightly glazed expression in her eyes dismays Jack. By even the widest, most comprehensive definition of sanity, this woman is not sane. He has no idea what to say to her.
"Would you care to sit down?"
With a hostessy wave of her hand, she indicates a high-backed wooden chair. "If it's all right with you."
"Why wouldn't it be all right? I'm going to sit down in my chair. Why shouldn't you sit down in that one?" "Thank you," Jack says, and sits down, watching her glide back to the door to check the lock.
Satisfied, Tansy gives him a brilliant smile and pads back to her chair, moving almost with the duck-waddle grace of a ballerina. When she lowers herself to the chair, he says,
"Are you afraid of someone who might come here, Tansy?
Is there someone you want to keep locked out?"
"Oh, yes," she says, and leans forward, pulling her eyebrows together in an exaggerated display of little girl seriousness. "But it isn't a someone. It's a thing. And I'm never, never going to let him in my house again. Not ever. But I'll let you in because you're a very nice man, and you gave me those beautiful flowers. And you're very handsome, too."
"Is Gorg the thing you want to keep out, Tansy? Are you afraid of Gorg?"
"Yes," she says primly. "Would you care for a cup of tea?"
"No, thank you."
"Well, I'm going to have some. It's very, very good tea. It tastes sort of like coffee."
She raises her eyebrows and gives him a bright, questioning look. He shakes his head. Without moving from her chair, Tansy pours two fingers of the brandy into her glass and sets the bottle back down on the table. The figure on her glass Jack sees is Scooby-Doo. Tansy sips from the glass.
"Yummy. Do you have a girlfriend? I could be your girlfriend, you know, especially if you gave me more of those lovely flowers. I put them in a vase."
She pronounces the word like a parody of a Boston matron, vase.
"See?"
On the kitchen counter, the lilies of the vale droop in a mason jar half filled with water. Removed from the territories, they do not have long to live. This world, Jack supposes, is poisoning them faster than they are able to deal with. Every ounce of goodness they yield to their surroundings subtracts from their essence. Tansy, he realizes, has been kept afloat on the residue of the territories remaining in the lilies. When they die, her protective little girl persona will crumble into dust, and her madness may engulf her. That madness came from Gorg. He'd bet his life on it.
"I do have a boyfriend, but he doesn't count. His name is Lester Moon. Beezer and his friends call him Stinky Cheese. But I don't know why. Lester isn't all that stinky, at least not when he's sober."
"Tell me about Gorg," Jack says. Extending her little finger away from the Scooby-Doo glass, Tansy takes another sip of coffee brandy. She frowns.
"Oh, that's a real icky thing to talk about."
"I want to know about him, Tansy. If you help me, I can make sure he never bothers you again."
"Really?"
"And you'd be helping me find the man who killed your daughter."
"I can't talk about that now. It's too upsetting."
Tansy flutters her free hand over her lap as if sweeping off a crumb. Her face contracts, and a new expression moves into her eyes. For a second, the desperate, unprotected Tansy rises to the surface, threatening to explode in a madness of grief and rage. Does Gorg look like a person, or like something else? Tansy shakes her head from side to side with great slowness. She is composing herself again, reinstating a personality that can ignore her real emotions.
Gorg does not look like a person. Not at all.
You said he gave you the feather you were wearing. Does he look like a bird?
Gorg doesn't look like a bird. He is a bird. And do you know what kind?
She leans forward again, and her face takes on the expression of a 6-year-old girl about to tell the worst thing she knows.
A raven. That's what he is, a big old raven. All black, but not shiny black.
Her eyes widen with the seriousness of what she has to say.
He came from Night's Plutonian Shore. That's from a poem Mrs. Normandy taught us in the 6th grade, The Raven by Edgar Allan Poe.
Tansy straightens up, having passed on this nugget of literary history. Jack guesses that Mrs. Normandy probably wore the same satisfied, pedagogic expression that is now on Tansy's face, but without the bright, unhealthy glaze in Tansy's eyes.
Night's Plutonian Shore is not part of this world, Tansy continues. Did you know that? It's alongside this world, and outside it. You need to find a door if you want to go there.
This is like talking to Judy Marshall, Jack abruptly realizes, but a Judy without the depth of soul and the unbelievable courage that rescued her from madness. The instant that Judy Marshall comes into his mind, he wants to see her again, so strongly that Judy feels like the one essential key to the puzzle all around him. And if she is the key, she is also the door the key opens. Jack wants to be out of the dark, warped atmosphere of Tansy's airstream. He wants to put off the Thunder 5 and speed up the highway and over the hill to Arden and the gloomy hospital where radiant Judy Marshall has found freedom in a locked mental ward.
But I don't ever want to find that door, because I don't want to go there, Tansy says in a sing-song voice. Night's Plutonian Shore is a bad world. Everything's on fire there.
How do you know that?
Gorg told me, she whispers.
Tansy's gaze skitters away from him and fastens on the Scooby-Doo glass.
Gorg likes fire, but not because it makes him warm, because it burns things up, and that makes him happy. Gorg said,
she shakes her head and lifts the glass to her mouth. Instead of drinking from it, she tilts the liquid toward the lip of the glass and laps at it with her tongue. Her eyes slide up to meet his again.
I think my tea is magic.
I bet you do, Jack thinks, and his heart nearly bursts for delicate lost Tansy.
You can't cry in here, she tells him. You looked like you wanted to cry, but you can't. Mrs. Normandy doesn't allow it. You can kiss me, though. Do you want to kiss me?
Of course I do, he says, but Mrs. Normandy doesn't allow kissing either.
Oh, well,
Tansy laps again at her drink.
We can do it later when she leaves the room, and you can put your arms around me like Lester Moon, and everything Lester does you can do with me.
Thank you, Jack says. Tansy, can you tell me some of the other things Gorg said? She cants her head and pushes her lips in and out.
He said he came here through a burning hole with folded back edges. And he said I was a mother and I had to help my daughter. In the poem, her name is Lenore, but her real name is Irma. And he said a mean old man ate her leg. But there were worse things that could have happened to my Irma.
For a couple of seconds, Tansy seems to recede into herself, to vanish behind her stationary surface. Her mouth remains half open. She does not even blink. When she returns from where she has gone, it is like watching a statue slowly come to life. Her voice is almost too soft to be heard.
I was supposed to fix that old man. Fix him, but good. Only you gave me my beautiful lilies, and he wasn't the right man.
Was he?
Jack feels like screaming.
He said there were worse things,
Tansy says, in a whisper of disbelief.
But he didn't say what they were. He showed me instead. And when I saw, I thought my eyes burned up, even though I could still see.
What did you see?
A big, big place, all made of fire,
Tansy says,
going way high up.
She falls silent, and an internal trembler runs through her, beginning in her face and moving down and out through her fingers.
Irma isn't there. No, she isn't. She got dead, and a mean old man ate her leg. He sent me a letter, but I never got it. So Gorg read it to me. I don't want to think about that letter.
She sounds like a little girl describing something she has heard about third hand or has invented. A thick curtain lies between Tansy and what she has seen and heard, and that curtain allows her to function. Jack again wonders what will happen to her when the lilies die.
And now, she says, if you're not going to kiss me, it's time you left. I want to be alone for a while.
Surprised by her decisiveness, Jack stands up and begins to say something polite and meaningless. Tansy waves him toward the door. Outside, the air seems heavy with bad odors and unseen chemicals. The lilies from the territories retained more power than Jack had imagined, enough to sweeten and purify Tansy's air. The ground beneath Jack's feet has been baked dry, and a parched sourness hangs in the atmosphere. Jack has nearly to force himself to breathe as he walks toward his truck. But the more he breathes, the more quickly he will readjust to the ordinary world. His world, though now it feels poisoned. He wants to do one thing only. Drive up Highway 93 to Judy Marshall's lookout point and keep on going, through Arden and into the parking lot, past the hospital doors, past the barriers of Dr. Spiegelman and Warden Jane Bond, until he can find himself once again in the life-giving presence of Judy Marshall herself. He almost thinks he loves Judy Marshall. Maybe he does love her. He knows he needs her. Judy is his door and his key. His door, his key. Whatever that means, it is the truth. All right, the woman he needs is married to the extremely nice Fred Marshall, but he doesn't want to marry her. In fact, he doesn't even want to sleep with her, not exactly. He just wants to stand before her and see what happens. Something will happen, that's for sure. But when he tries to picture it, all he sees is an explosion of tiny red feathers. Hardly the image he was hoping for. Feeling unsteady, Jack props himself on the cab of his truck with one hand while he grabs the door handle with the other. Both surfaces sear his hands, and he waves them in the air for a little while. When he gets into the cab, the seat is hot, too. He rolls down his window, and with a twinge of loss, notices that the world smells normal to him again. It smells fine. It smells like summer. Where is he going to go? That is an interesting question, he thinks. But after he gets back on the road and travels no more than 100 feet, the low, gray, wooden shape of the sand bar appears on his left. And without hesitating, he turns into the absurdly extensive parking lot, as if he knew where he was going all along. Looking for a shady spot, Jack cruises around to the back of the building and sees the bar's single hint of landscaping, a broad maple tree that rises out of the asphalt at the far end of the lot. He guides the Ram into the maple shadow and gets out, leaving the windows cranked down. Waves of heat ripple upward from the only other two cars in the lot. It is 11:20 a.m. He is getting hungry, too, since his breakfast consisted of a cup of coffee and a slice of toast smeared with marmalade, and that was 3 hours ago. Jack has the feeling that the afternoon is going to be a long one. He might as well have something to eat while he waits for the bikers.
The back door of the sand bar opens onto a narrow restroom alcove that leads into a long rectangular space with a gleaming bar at one side and a row of substantial wooden booths on the other. Two big pool tables occupy the middle of the room, and a jukebox stands set back against the wall between them. At the front of the room, a big television screen hangs where it can be seen by everyone, suspended 8 or 9 feet above the clean wooden floor. The sound has been muted on a commercial that never quite identifies the purpose of its product. After the glare of the parking lot, the bar seems pleasantly dark, and while Jack's eyes adjust, the few low lamps appear to send out hazy beams of light. The bartender, whom Jack takes to be the famous Lester Stinky Cheese Moon, looks up once as Jack enters, then returns to the copy of the Herald folded open on the bar. When Jack takes a stool a few feet to his right, he looks up again. Stinky Cheese is not as awful as Jack had expected. He is wearing a clean shirt, only a few shades wider than his round, small-featured face and his shaven head. Moon has the unmistakable air, half professional and half resentful, of someone who has taken over the family business and suspects he could have done better elsewhere. Jack's intuition tells him that this sense of weary frustration is the source of his nickname among the bikers, because it gives him the look of one who expects to encounter a nasty smell any minute now. "Can I get something to eat here?" Jack asks him. "It's all listed on the board." The bartender turns sideways and indicates a white board with movable letters that spell out the menu. Hamburger, cheeseburger, hot dog, bratwurst, kielbasa, sandwiches, french fries, onion rings. The man's gesture is intended to make Jack feel unobservant, and it works. "Sorry, I didn't see the sign." The bartender shrugs. "Cheeseburger, medium with fries, please. Lunch don't start until 11:30, which it says on the board, see?" Another half-mocking gesture toward the sign. "But Mom is setting up in back. I could give her the order now, and she'll start in on it when she's ready." Jack thanks him, and the bartender glances up at the television screen and walks down to the end of the bar and disappears around a corner. A few seconds later, he returns, looks up at the screen, and asks Jack what he would like to drink. "Ginger ale," Jack says. Watching the screen, Lester Moon squirts ginger ale from a nozzle into a beer glass and pushes the glass toward Jack. Then he slides his hand down the bar to pick up the remote control and says, "Hope you don't mind, but I was watching this old movie. Pretty funny." He punches a button on the remote, and from over his left shoulder, Jack hears his mother's voice say, "Looks like Smokey's coming in late today. I wish that little rascal would learn how to handle his liquor." Before he can turn sideways to face the screen, Lester Moon is asking him if he remembers Lily Cavanaugh. "Oh, yes. I always liked her when I was a kid." "Same here," Jack says. As Jack had known instantly, the movie is The Terror of Deadwood Gulch, a 1950 comic western in which the then-famous and still fondly remembered Bill Towns, a sort of poor man's Bob Hope, played a cowardly gambler and card sharp who arrives in the little Potemkin community of Deadwood Gulch, Arizona, and is soon mistaken for a notorious gunfighter. As the beautiful, quick-witted owner of a saloon called the Lazy Eight, the lively center of village social life, Lily Cavanaugh is much appreciated by the crowd of cowpokes, loungers, ranchers, merchants, lawmen, and riffraff who fill her place every night. She makes her patrons check their revolvers at the door and mind their manners, which tend toward the Apopanax. In the scene playing now, which is about half an hour into the movie, Lily is alone in her saloon trying to get rid of a persistent bee. A bee for the queen of the bees, Jack thinks, and smiles. At the buzzing nuisance, Lily flaps a cleaning rag, a fly swatter, a mop, a broom, a gun belt. The bee eludes her every effort, zooming here and there, from the bar to a card table, to the top of a whiskey bottle, the tops of 3 other bottles all in a row, the lid of the upright piano, often waiting while its adversary comes sneaking up by subtle indirection, then taking off a second before the latest weapon slams down. It is a lovely little sequence that verges on slapstick, And when Jackie was 666, or maybe 7, half hysterical with laughter at the sight of his competent mother failing repeatedly to vanquish this flying annoyance, and suddenly curious as to how the movie guys had made the insect do all these things, his mother had explained that it was not a real bee, but an enchanted one produced by the special effects department. Lester Moon says, "I could never figure out how they got the bee to go where they wanted. Like, what did they do, train it?" "First they filmed her alone on the set," Jack says, having concluded that after all, Stinky Cheese is a pretty decent fellow with great taste in actresses. "Special effects put the bee in later. It isn't a real bee, it's a drawing, an animation. You really can't tell, can you?" "No way. Are you sure? How do you know that, anyhow?" "I read it in a book somewhere," Jack says, using his all-purpose response to such questions. Resplendent in fancy card-sharp get-up, Bill Town saunters through the Lazy Eight swinging doors and leers at its proprietress without noticing that she is edging toward the bee now once again installed upon the shiny bar. He has romance in mind, and he swaggers when he walks. "I see you came back for more, hot shot," Lily says. "You must like the place." "Baby, this is the sweetest joint west of the wide Missouri. Reminds me of the place where I beat Black Jack McGurk to the draw. Poor Black Jack, he never did know when to fold him." With a noise like the revving of a B-52, the enchanted bee, a creature of fiction inside the fiction, launches itself at Bill Towns's slickly behatted head. The comedian's face turns rubbery with comic terror. He waves his arms, he jigs, he screeches. The enchanted bee performs aeronautic stunts around the panicky pseudo-gunfighter. Towns's splendid hat falls off, his hair disarranges itself. He edges toward a table and, with a final flurry of hand-waving, dives under it and begs for help. Eye fixed on the ambling bee, Lily walks to the bar and picks up a glass and a folded newspaper. She approaches the table, watching the bee walking around in circles. She jumps forward and lowers the glass, trapping the bee. It flies up and bumps the bottom of the glass. Lily tilts the glass, slides the folded paper underneath it, and raises her hands, holding the newspaper against the top of the glass. The camera pulls back, and we see the cowardly gambler peeking out from under the table as Lily pushes the doors open and releases the bee. Behind him, Lester Moon says, "Cheeseburger's ready, mister." For the next half hour, Jack eats his burger and tries to lose himself in the movie. The burger is great, world class, with that juicy taste you can get only from a greased-up griddle. And the fries are perfect, golden and crunchy on the outside. But his concentration keeps wandering from the terror of Deadwood Gulch. The problem is not that he has seen the movie perhaps a dozen times. The problem is Tansy Freneau. Certain things she said trouble him. The more he thinks about them, the less he understands what is going on. According to Tansy, the crow, the raven, named Gorg, came from a world alongside and outside the world we know. She had to be talking about the territories. Using a phrase from Poe's The Raven, she called this other world Night's Plutonian Shore, which was pretty good for someone like Tansy, but did not seem in any way applicable to the magical territories. Gorg had told Tansy that everything in his world was on fire, and not even the blasted lands met that description. Jack could remember the blasted lands and the odd train that had taken him and Rational Richard, then a sick, wasted Rational Richard, across that vast red desert. Strange creatures had lived there, alligator men and birds with the faces of bearded monkeys, but it had certainly not been on fire. The blasted lands were the product of some past disaster, not the site of a present conflagration. What had Tansy said? A big, big place made all of fire going way high up. What had she seen? To what landscape had Gorg opened her eyes? It sounded like a great, burning tower or a tall building consumed by fire. A burning tower, a burning building in a burning world. How could that world be the territories? Jack has been in the territories twice in the past 48 hours, and what he has seen has been beautiful. More than beautiful, cleansing. The deepest truth Jack knows about the territories is that they contain a kind of sacred magic, the magic he saw in Judy Marshall. Because of that magic, the territories can confer a wondrous blessing on human beings. The life of that extraordinary, tough, beloved woman making fun of Bill Towns on the big screen before him was saved by an object from the territories. Because Jack had been in the territories, and maybe because he had held the talisman, almost every horse he bets on comes in first. Every stock he buys triples in value. Every poker hand he holds takes the pot. So what world is Tansy talking about? And what's all this stuff about Gorg coming here through a burning hole? When Jack flipped over yesterday, he had sensed something unhappy, something unhealthy, far off to the southwest, and he suspected that was where he would find the fisherman's twinner. Kill the fisherman, kill the twinner. It didn't matter which he did first, the other one would weaken. But it still didn't make sense. When you travel between worlds, you just flip. You don't set a fire at the world's edge and run through it into another one. A few minutes before 12, the rumble of motorcycles drowns the voices on the screen. Mister, you might want to take off, says Moon. That's the Thunder Five, Jack says. I know. Okay. It's just they scare the shit out of some of my customers. But as long as you treat them right, they act okay. I know. There's nothing to worry about. I mean, if you buy him a beer or something, they'll think you're all right. Jack gets off his stool and faces the bartender. Lester, there's no reason to be nervous. They're coming here to meet me. Lester blinks. For the first time, Jack notices that his eyebrows are thin, curved wisps, like those of a 1920s vamp. Okay? Okay? I'd better start pouring a pitcher of Kingsland. He grabs a pitcher from beneath the bar, sets it under the Kingsland ale tap, and opens the valve. A thick stream of amber liquid rushes into the pitcher and turns to foam. The sound of the motorcycles builds to an uproar at the front of the building, then cuts off. Beezer St. Pierre bangs through the door, closely followed by Doc, Mouse, Sonny, and Kaiser Bill. They look like Vikings, and Jack is overjoyed to see them. Stinky, turn that TV the fuck off, Beezer roars. And we didn't come here to drink, so empty that pitcher into the drain. The way you pour, it's all head anyhow. And when you're done, get back in the kitchen with your mama. Our business with this man's got nothing to do with you. Okay, Beezer, Moon says in a shaky voice. All I need is a second. And that's what you got, Beezer says. Beezer and the others line up in front of the bar, some of them staring at Stinky Cheese, some more kindly at Jack. Mouse is still wearing his cornrows, and he has daubed some black anti-glare substance beneath his eyes, like a football player. Kaiser Bill and Sonny have pulled their manes back into ponytails again. Ale and foam slide out of the pitcher and seep into the drain. Okay, guys, Moon says. His footsteps retreat along the back of the bar. A door closes. The members of the Thunder Five separate and spread out in front of Jack. Most of them have crossed their arms on their chests, and muscles bulge. Jack pushes his plate to the back of the bar, stands up, and says, "Before last night, had any of you guys ever heard of George Potter?" From his perch on the edge of the pool table nearest to the front door, Jack faces Beezer and Doc, who lean forward on their bar stools. Kaiser Bill, one finger against his lips and his head bowed, stands beside Beezer. Mouse lies stretched out on the second pool table, propping his head up with one hand. Banging his fists together and scowling, Sonny is pacing back and forth between the bar and the jukebox. "You sure he didn't say Bleak House like the Dickens novel?" Mouse says. "I'm sure," says Jack, reminding himself that he should not be surprised every time one of these guys demonstrates that he went to college. "It was Black House." "Geez, I almost think I..." Mouse shakes his head. "What was the builder's name again?" asks Beezer. "Burnside. First name probably Charles, sometimes known as Chummy. A long time ago, he changed it from something like Bierstein.
Bierstein? Bernstein?
You got me, Jack says.
And you think he's the fisherman?
Jack nods. Beezer is staring at him as if trying to see the back of his head.
How sure are you?
99%. He planted the Polaroids in Potter's room.
Damn!
Beezer pushes himself off his stool and walks around to the back of the bar.
I want to make sure nobody forgets the obvious.
He bends down and straightens up with a telephone book in one hand.
Know what I mean?
Beezer opens the directory on the bar, flips a few pages, flips back, and runs his thick finger down a column of names.
No Burnside, too bad.
Good idea, though, Jack says. This morning I tried the same thing myself. Sonny pauses on his return journey from the jukebox and jabs a finger at Jack.
How long ago was this damn house built?
Nearly 30 years ago, during the '70s.
Well, we were all kids then, back in Illinois. How are we supposed to know about that house?
You guys get around. I thought there was a pretty good chance you might have seen it. And the place is spooky. People tend to talk about houses like that. They did in normal cases, at least, Jack thought. In normal cases, spooky houses got that way because they had been empty for a couple of years, or because something terrible had happened in them. In this case, he thought, the house itself was terrible, and the people who otherwise would have talked about it could barely remember seeing it. Judging by Dale's response, Black House had vanished into its own non-existent shadow. He says, think about this, try to remember. In the years you've been living in French Landing, have you ever heard of a house that seemed to have a curse on it? Black House caused injuries to the people who built it. The workmen hated the place. They were afraid of it. They said you couldn't see your shadow when you got near it. They were claiming it was haunted while they worked on it. Eventually, they all quit, and Burnside had to finish the job himself.
It's off by itself somewhere, Doc says. Obviously, this thing isn't sitting around in plain view. It's not in some development like Libertyville. You're not going to find it on Robin Hood Lane.
Right, Jack says. I should have mentioned that before. Potter told me it was built a little way off what he called the road, in a kind of clearing. So it's in the woods. Doc, you're right, it's isolated.
Hey, 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 Mouse says, swinging his legs over the side of the pool table and grunting himself upright.
His eyes are screwed shut, and he claps one meaty hand on his forehead.
If I could only remember...
He lets out a howl of frustration.
What?
Beezer's voice is at twice its normal volume, and the word sounds like a paving stone hitting a cement sidewalk.
I know! I saw that fucking place, he says. As soon as you started talking about it, I had this feeling it sounded kind of familiar. It kept hanging at the back of my mind, but it wouldn't come out. When I tried to think about it, you know, make myself remember, I kept seeing these sparkly lights.
When Jack said it was back in the woods, I knew what he was talking about. I had a clear picture of the place, surrounded by all these sparkling lights.
That doesn't sound much like Black House, Jack says.
Sure it does. The lights weren't really there. I just saw them.
Mouse offers this observation as though it is completely rational.
Sonny utters a bark of laughter, and Beezer shakes his head and says, shit.
I don't get it, Jack says.
Beezer looks at Jack, holds up one finger, and asks Mouse,
are we talking about July, August, 2 years ago?
Naturally, Mouse says. The summer of the ultimate acid. He looks at Jack and smiles.
2 years ago, we got this amazing, amazing acid. Drop a tab, you're in for 5 or 6 hours of the most unbelievable head games. Nobody ever had a bad experience with the stuff. It was all groove. Know what I mean?
I suppose I can guess, Jack says.
You could even do your job behind it.
For sure you could drive, man. Get on your hog, go anywhere you could think of. Doing anything normal was a piece of cake. You weren't fucked up. You were operating way beyond your max.
Timothy Leary wasn't all wrong, Doc says.
God, that was great stuff, Mouse says. We did it until there was no more to do, and then the whole thing was over, the whole acid thing. If you couldn't get that stuff, there was no point in taking anything else. I never knew where it came from.
You don't want to know where it came from, says Beezer. Trust me.
So you were doing this acid when you saw Black House, Jack says.
Sure. That's why I saw the lights.
Very slowly, Beezer asks,
Where is it, Mouse? I don't exactly know.
But hold on, Beezer, let me talk. That was the summer I was tight with a little Nancy Hale, remember?
Sure, Beezer says. That was a damn shame. He glances at Jack. Little Nancy died right after that summer. Tore me apart, Mouse says. It was like she turned allergic to air and sunlight all of a sudden. Sick all the time, rashes all over her body. She couldn't stand being outside because the light hurt her eyes. Doc couldn't figure out what was wrong with her, so we took her to the big hospital in La Riviere, but they couldn't find out what was wrong either. We talked to a couple of guys at Mayo, but they weren't any help. She died hard, man. Broke your heart to see it happen. Broke mine for sure.
He falls silent for a long moment, during which he stares down at his gut and his knees, and no one else says a word.
All right, Mouse finally says, raising his head. Here's what I remember. On this Saturday, little Nancy and I were tripping on the Ultimate, just riding around to some places we liked. We went to the Riverfront Park in La Riviere, drove over to Dog Island and Lookout Point. We came back this direction and went up on the bluff. Beautiful, man. After that, we didn't feel like going home, so we just wheeled around. Little Nancy noticed this no trespassing sign I must have passed about 1,000 times before without seeing it.
He looks at Jack Sawyer.
I can't say for certain, but I think it was on 35.
Jack nods.
If we hadn't been on the Ultimate, I don't think she ever would have seen that sign either.
Oh, man, it's all coming back to me. What's that? She says. And I swear I had to look 2 or 3 times before I saw that sign. It was all beat up and bent with a couple of rusty bullet holes in it, sort of leaning back into the trees.
Somebody wants to keep us off that road, little Nancy says. What are they hiding up there anyhow?
Something like that. What road? I ask. And then I see it. It's hardly even what you could call a road. About wide enough for a car to fit in if you have a compact. Thick trees on both sides. Hell, I didn't think anything interesting was hidden up there, unless it was an old shack. Besides that, I didn't like the way it looked. He glances at Beezer.
What do you mean you didn't like the way it looked? Beezer asks. I've seen you go into places you damn well knew were no good. Or are you getting mystical on me, Mouse?
Call it what you fucking want. I'm telling you how it was.
It was like that sign was saying, keep out if you know what's good for you. Gave me a bad feeling.
On account of it was a bad place, Sonny interrupts. I've seen some bad places. They don't want you there, and they let you know.
Beezer shoots him a measured look and says, I don't care how evil this bad place is. If it's where the fisherman lives, I'm going there.
And I'm going with you, says Mouse, but just listen. I wanted to bag it and get some fried chicken or something, which combined with the Ultimate would have been like eating the food of paradise, or whatever Coleridge said. But little Nancy wanted to go in because she had the same feeling I did. She was a game broad, man. Ornery, too. So I turned in. And little Nancy's hanging on in back of me, and she's saying, don't be a pussy, Mouse, let's haul ass. So I gun it a little bit, and everything feels all weird and shit. But all I can see is this track curving away into the trees, and the shit I know isn't there.
Like what? Asks Sonny, in what sounds like the spirit of scientific enquiry.
These dark shapes coming up to the edge of the road and looking out through the trees. A couple of them ran toward me, but I rolled right through them like smoke. I don't know. Maybe they were smoke.
Fuck that. It was the acid, Beezer says.
Maybe, but it didn't feel that way. Besides, the Ultimate never turned on you, remember? It wasn't about darkness. Anyhow, right before the shit hit the fan, all of a sudden I was thinking about Kiz Martin. I can remember that, all right. It was like I could practically see her right in front of me, the way she looked when they loaded her in the ambulance.
Kiz Martin, Beezer says.
Mouse turns to Jack.
Kiz was a girl I went out with when we were all at the university. She used to beg us to let her ride with us, and one day the Kaiser said okay, she could borrow his bike. Kiz was having a ball, man. She's digging it. And then she rolls over some damn little twig, I think it was.
Bigger than a twig, Doc says. Little branch, maybe 2 inches in diameter.
Which is just enough to test your balance, especially if you're not used to hogs, Mouse says. She rolls over at his little branch, and the bike flops over, and Kiz flies off and hits the road. My heart damn near stopped, man.
I knew she was gone the second I came up close enough to see the angle of her head, says Doc. There wasn't even any point in trying CPR. We covered her with our jackets, and I rode off to call an ambulance. 10 minutes later, they were loading her in. One of the guys recognized me from my stint in the ER, or they might have given us some trouble.
I wondered if you were really a doctor, Jack says. Completed my residency in surgery at UI and walked away from the whole deal right there.
Doc smiles at him.
Hanging around with these guys, getting into beer brewing, sounded like more fun than spending all day cutting people up.
Mouse, Beezer says.
Yeah. I was just getting to the curve in the little road, and it was like Kiz was standing right in front of me. It was so vivid. Her eyes closed and her head hanging like a leaf about to fall. Oh, man, I said to myself, this is not what I want to see at this particular moment. I could feel it all over again, the way I felt when Kiz hit the road. Sick dread. That's the word for it, sick dread. And we come around the curve, and I hear this dog growling somewhere off in the woods. Not just growling, growling. Like 20 big dogs are out there, and they're all mad as hell. My head starts feeling like it wants to explode. And I look up ahead of me to see if a pack of wolves or something is running toward us, and it takes me a while to realize that the weird shadowy stuff I see up ahead is a house. A black house. Little Nancy is hitting me on the back and rapping my head, screaming at me to stop. Believe me, I can get with the program because the last thing I want to do is get any closer to that place. I stop the bike and little Nancy jumps off and pukes on the side of the road. She holds her head and she pukes some more. I'm feeling like my legs turn to rubber, like something heavy is pressing on my chest. That thing, whatever it is still going nuts in the woods, and it's getting closer. I take another look up at the end of the road, and that ugly damn house is stretching back into the woods like it's crawling into them, only it's standing still. It gets bigger the more you look at it. Then I see the spark lights floating around it, and they look dangerous. Stay away, they're telling me. Get out of here, Mouse. There's another no trespassing sign leaning against the porch, and that sign, man, that sign kind of flashed, like it was saying, this time I mean it, buddy. My head is splitting in half, but I get little Nancy on the bike, and she sags against me like pure dead weight, except she's hanging on, and I kick the hog on and spin around and take off. When we get back to my place, she goes to bed and stays there for 3 days. To me, it seemed like I could hardly remember what happened. The whole thing went kind of dark in my mind. I hardly had time to think about it anyhow, because little Nancy got sick and I had to take care of her whenever I wasn't at work. Doc gave her some stuff to get her temperature down, and she got better so we could drink beer and smoke shit and ride around like before. But she was never really the same. End of August, she started getting bad again, and I had to put her in the hospital. Second week of September, hard as she was fighting, little Nancy passed away. How big was little Nancy? Jack asks, picturing a woman roughly the size of Mouse.
Little Nancy Hale was about the size and shape of Tansy Furneaux, Mouse says, looking surprised by the question.
If she stood on my hand, I could lift her up with one arm.
And you never talked about this with anyone, Jack says.
How could I talk about it? Mouse asks. First, I was crazy with worry about little Nancy, and then it went clean out of my head.
Weird shit will do that to you, man. Instead of sticking in your head, it erases itself.
I know exactly what you mean, Jack says.
I guess I do, too, says Beezer. But I'd say that the ultimate kicked the shit out of your reality there for a while. You did see the place, though, Black House.
Damn straight, says Mouse.
Beezer focuses on Jack. And you say the fisherman, this Creek Burnside, built it. Jack nods. So maybe he's living there and he rigged up a bunch of gadgets to scare people away.
Could be.
Then I think we're going to let Mouse take us over on Highway 35 and see if he can find that little road he was talking about. Are you coming with us?
I can't, Jack says. I have to see someone in Arden first, someone who I think can also help us. She has another piece of the puzzle, but I can't explain it to you until I see her.
This woman knows something?
Oh, yes, Jack says. She knows something.
All right, Beezer says and stands up from his stool. Your choice. We'll have to talk to you afterward.
Beezer, I want to be with you when you go inside Black House. Whatever we have to do in there, whatever we see.
Jack pauses, trying to find the right words. Beezer is rocking on his heels, practically jumping out of his skin in his eagerness to hunt down the fisherman's lair.
You're going to want me there. There's more to this business than you can imagine, Beezer. You're going to know what I'm talking about in a little while, and you'll be able to stand up to it. I think all of you will. But if I tried to describe it now, you wouldn't believe me. When the time comes, you'll need me to see you through, if we get through. You'll be glad I was there. We're at a dangerous point here, and none of us wants to mess it up.
What makes you think I'll mess it up? Beezer asks with deceptive mildness.
Anyone would mess it up if they didn't have the last piece of the puzzle. Go out there, see if Mouse can find the house he saw 2 years ago. Check it out. Don't go in. To do that, you need me. After you check it out, come back here and I'll see you as soon as I can. I should be back before 2:30, 3 at the latest.
Where are you going in Arden? Maybe I'll want to call you.
French County Lutheran Hospital, Ward D. If you can't get me, leave a message with a Dr. Spiegelman.
Ward D, huh? Beezer says. Okay, I guess everybody's crazy today. And I guess I can be satisfied with only a look at this house, as long as I know that sometime this afternoon I can count on you to explain all these pieces I'm too stupid to understand.
It'll be soon, Beezer. We're closing in. And the last thing I'd call you is stupid.
I guess you must have been one hell of a cop, Beezer says. Even though I think half the stuff you say is crap, I can't help but believe it.
He turns around and brings his fists down on the bar.
Stinky cheese! It's safe now. Drag your pale ass out of the kitchen.
Chapter 19. Jack follows the Thunder Five out of the parking lot, and for the moment we will let him go alone on his northward way on Highway 93 toward Judy Marshall's lookout and Judy Marshall's locked ward. Like Jack, the bikers are headed toward the unknown, but their unknown lies westward on Highway 35 into the land of the steadily accumulating past, and we want to know what they will find there. These men do not appear to be nervous. They still project the massive confidence with which they burst into the sandbar. In truth, they never really display nervousness, for situations that would make other people worried or anxious generally make them get physical. Fear affects them differently than it does other people, too. In the rare moments when they have experienced fear, they've tended on the whole to enjoy it. In their eyes, fear represents a God-given opportunity for focusing their collective concentration. Due to their remarkable solidarity, that concentration is formidable. For those of us who are not members of a biker gang or the Marine Corps, solidarity means little more than the compassionate impulse that leads us to comfort a bereft friend. For Beezer and his merry band, solidarity is the assurance that someone's always got your back. They are on each other's hands, and they know it. For the Thunder Five, safety really is in numbers. Yet the encounter toward which they are flying has no precedents or analogs in their experience. Black House is something new, and its newness, the sheer strangeness of Mouse's story, sinks tendrils down into their guts, one and all.
8 miles west of Centralia, where the flatland around Potsey's 30-year-old development yields to the long stretch of woods that runs all the way to Maxton's, Mouse and Beezer ride side by side in front of the others. Beezer occasionally looks to his friend, asking a wordless question. The third time that Mouse shakes his head, he follows the gesture with a backward wave of his hand that says, "Stop bugging me, I'll tell you when we're there." Beezer drops back. Sonny, Kaiser Bill, and Doc automatically assume Beezer is giving them a signal, and they string out in a single line. At the head of the column, Mouse keeps taking his eyes off the highway to inspect the right-hand side of the road. The little road is hard to see, Mouse knows, and by now it will be more overgrown than it was 2 years ago. He is trying to spot the white of the battered no trespassing sign. It, too, may be partially hidden by new growth. He slows down to 35. The foreman behind him matches change in pace with the smoothness of long practice. Alone of the Thunder Five, Mouse has already seen their destination, and in the deepest places of his soul, he can scarcely believe that he is going there again. At first, the ease and rapidity with which his memories had flown out of their dark vault had pleased him. Now, instead of feeling that he has effortlessly reclaimed a lost part of his life, he has the sense of being at the mercy of that lost afternoon. A grave danger then, and he does not doubt that some great and dangerous force had brushed him with a warning hand, is an increased danger now. Memory has returned a miserable conclusion he thrust away long ago, that the hideous structure Jack Sawyer called Black House had killed little Nancy Hale as surely as if its rafters had fallen in on her. Moral more than physical, Black House's ugliness exhaled toxic fumes. Little Nancy had been killed by the invisible poisons carried on the warning hand. Now Mouse had to look at that knowledge without blinking. He can feel her hands on his shoulders, and their thin bones are covered with rotting flesh. If I'd been 5'3" and weighed 105 pounds instead of being 6'2" and 290, by now I'd be rotting too, he thinks. Mouse may look for the narrow road and the sign beside it with the eyes of a fighter pilot, but someone else has to see them, because he never will. His unconscious has taken a vote, and the decision was unanimous. Each of the other men, Sonny, Doc, the Kaiser, and even Beezer, have also connected little Nancy's death with Black House, and the same speculations about comparative size and weight have passed through their minds. However, Sonny Cantanaro, Doc Amberson, Kaiser Bill Strassner, and especially Beezer St. Pierre assume that whatever poison surrounded Black House had been concocted in a laboratory by human beings who knew what they were doing. These four men derive the old primitive reassurance from one another's company that they have enjoyed since college. If anything makes them feel a touch uneasy, it is that Mouse Bauman, not Beezer, leads their column. Even though Beezer let Mouse wave him back, Mouse's position contains a hint of insurrection, of mutiny. The universe has been subtly disordered. 20 yards from the back end of the Maxton property, Sonny decides to put an end to this farce, guns his soft tail, roars past his friends, and moves up parallel to Mouse. Mouse glances at him with a trace of worry, and Sonny motions to the side of the road. When they have all pulled over, Mouse says, "What's your problem, Sonny?" "You are," Sonny says. "Either you missed a turnoff or your whole story's all fucked up." "I said I wasn't sure where it is." He notices with nearly immeasurable relief that little Nancy's dead hands no longer grip his shoulders. "Of course not. You are ripped on acid." "Good acid." "Well, there's no road up ahead, I know that much. It's just trees all the way to the old fox home." Mouse ponders the stretch of road ahead
as if the road just might be up there after all, although he knows it is not.
Shit, Mouse! We're practically in town. I can see Queen Street from here.
Yeah, Mouse says. Okay. If he can get to Queen Street, he thinks, those hands will never fasten on him again. Beezer walks his electroglide up to them and says, okay, what, Mouse? You agree it's farther back or is the road somewhere else? Frowning, Mouse turns his head to look back down the highway.
God damn! I think it's along here somewhere, unless I got totally turned around that day.
Gee, how could that have happened? Says Sonny. I looked at every inch of ground we passed, and I sure as hell didn't see a road. Did you, Beezer? How about a no trespassing sign? You happen to see one of those?
You don't get it, Mouse says. This shit doesn't want to be seen.
Maybe you should have gone to Ward D with Sawyer, Sonny says. People in there appreciate visionaries.
Can it, Sonny? Beezer says. I was there before and you weren't, Mouse says. Which one of us knows what he's talking about?
I've heard enough out of both of you guys, Beezer says. Do you still think it's along here somewhere, Mouse?
As far as I can recollect, yeah.
Then we missed it. We'll go back and check again, and if we don't find it, we'll look somewhere else. If it's not here, it's between two of the valleys along 93, or in the woods on the hill leading up to the lookout. We have plenty of time.
What makes you so sure? Sonny asks.
Mild anxiety about what they might come across is making him belligerent. He would just as soon go back to the sandbar and down a pitcher at Kingsland while messing with Stinky's head as waste his time goofing along the highways.
Beezer looks at him and his eyes crackle. You know anywhere else there's enough trees to call it a woods?
Sonny backs down immediately. Beezer is never going to give up and go back to the sandbar. Beezer is in this for keeps. Most of that has to do with Amy, but some of it relates to Jack Sawyer. Sawyer impressed the shit out of Beezer the other night. That's what happened. And now Beezer thinks everything the guy says is golden. To Sonny, this makes no sense at all, but Beezer's the one who calls the shots. So, for now, Sonny guesses, they will all run around like junior G-men for a while. If this adopt-a-cop program goes on for more than a couple of days, Sonny plans to have a little chat with Mouse and the Kaiser. Doc will always side with Beezer no matter what, but the other two are capable of listening to reason.
All right, then, Beezer says. Scratch from here to Queen Street. We know there's no fucking road along that stretch. We'll go back the way we came, give it one more shot. Single file the whole way. Mouse, your point man again.
Mouse nods and prepares himself to feel those hands on his shoulders again. Gunning his fat boy, he rolls forward and takes his place at the head of the line. Beezer moves in behind him, and Sonny follows Beezer, with Doc and the Kaiser in the last two slots.
Five pairs of eyes, Sonny thinks. If we don't see it this time, we never will. And we won't, because that damned road is halfway across the state. When Mouse and his old lady got buzzed on the ultimate, they could go for hundreds of miles and think they'd taken a spin around the block.
Everybody scans the opposite side of the road and the edge of the woods. Five pairs of eyes, as Sonny puts it, register an unbroken line of oaks and pine trees. Mouse has set a pace somewhere between a fast walk and a medium jog, and the trees crawl by. At this speed, they can notice the moss blistering the trunks of the oaks and the bright smears of sunlight on the forest's floor, which is brownish-gray and resembles a layer of rumpled felt. A hidden world of upright trees, shafts of light, and deadfalls extends backwards from the first sentinel row. Within that world, paths that are not paths wind maze-like between the thick trunks and lead to mysterious clearings. Sonny becomes suddenly aware of a tribe of squirrels doing squirrel gymnastics in the map of branches that lace into an intermittent canopy. And with the squirrels, an aviary of birds pops into view. All of this reminds him of the deep Pennsylvania woods he had explored as a boy before his parents sold their house and moved to Illinois. Those woods had contained a rapture he had found nowhere else. Sonny's conviction that Mouse got things wrong and they are looking in the wrong place takes on greater inner density. Earlier, Sonny had spoken about bad places,
of which he has seen at least one he was absolutely certain about. In Sonny's experience, bad places, the ones that let you know you are not welcome, tended to be on or near borders. During the summer after his high school graduation, he and his two best buddies, all of them motorcycle freaks, had taken their bikes to Rice Lake, Wisconsin, where he had two cousins cute enough to show off to his friends. Sal and Harry were thrilled with the girls, and the girls thought the bikers were sexy and exotic. After a couple of days spent as a literal fifth wheel, or fifth and sixth wheel, depending on what you're counting, Sonny proposed extending their trip by a week, and in the interest of expanding their educations, balling the Jack down to Chicago and spending the rest of their money on beer and hookers until they had to go home. Sal and Harry loved the whole idea, and on their third evening in Rice Lake, they packed their rolls on their bikes and roared south, making as much noise as possible. By 10 o'clock, they had managed to get completely lost. It might have been the beer, it might have been inattention, but for one reason or another, they had wandered off the highway, and in the deep black of a rural night, found themselves on the edge of an almost non-existent town named Harco. Harco could not be found on their gas station roadmap, but it had to be close to the Illinois border on either one side or the other. Harco seemed to consist of an abandoned motel, a collapsing general store, and an empty grain mill. When the boys reached the mill, Sal and Harry groused about being exhausted and hungry and wanted to turn back to spend the night in the motel. Sonny, who was no less worn out, rode back with them. The second they rolled into the dark forecourt of the motel, he had a bad feeling about the place. The air seemed heavier, the darkness darker than they should have been. To Sonny it seemed that malign, invisible presences haunted the place. He could all but make them out as they flitted between the cabins. Sal and Harry jeered at his reservations. He was a coward, a fairy, a girl. They broke down a door and unrolled their sleeping bags in a bare, dusty, rectangular room. He carried his across the street and slept in a field. Dawn awakened him, and his face was wet with dew. He jumped up, pissed into the high grass, and checked for the motorcycles on the other side of the road. There they were, all three of them, listing over their stands outside a broken door. The dead neon sign at the entrance of the forecourt read Honeymoon's Bower. He walked across the narrow road and swept a hand over the moisture shining black on the seats of the motorcycles. A funny sound came from the room where his friends were sleeping. Already tasting dread, Sonny pushed open the broken door. If he had not initially refused to make sense of what was before him, what he saw in the room would have made him pass out. His face streaked with blood and tears, Sal Terso was sitting on the floor. Harry Riley's severed head rested in his lap, and an ocean of blood soaked the floor and daubed the walls. Harry's body lay loose and disjointed on top of his blood-soaked sleeping bag. The body was naked. Sal wore only a blood-red T-shirt. Sal raised both his hands, the one holding his prize long-bladed knife, and the one holding only a palmful of blood, and lifted his contorted face to Sonny's frozen gaze.
"I don't know what happened."
His voice was high and screechy, not his.
"I don't remember doing this. How could I have done this? Help me, Sonny. I don't know what happened."
Unable to speak, Sonny had backed out and flown away on his cycle. He'd had no clear idea of where he was going, except that it was out of Harco. 2 miles down the road, he came to a little town, a real one, with people in it, and someone finally took him to the sheriff's office. Harco. There was a bad place. In a way, both of his high school friends had died there, because Sal Terso hanged himself 6 months after being committed to a state penitentiary for life on a second-degree murder charge. In Harco, you saw no red-winged blackbirds or woodpeckers. Even sparrows steered clear of Harco.
This little stretch of 35? Nothing but a nice, comfortable woodland. Let me tell you, Senator, Sonny Cantanaro has seen Harco, and this ain't no Harco. This don't even come close. It might as well be in another world. What meets Sonny's appraising eye and increasingly impatient spirit is about a mile and a quarter of beautiful wooded landscape. You could call it a mini-forest. He thinks it would be cool to come out here by himself one day, tuck the Harley out of sight, and just walk around through the great oaks and pines, that big pad of felt beneath his feet, digging the birds and the crazy squirrels. Sonny gazes at and through the sentinel trees on the far side of the road, enjoying his anticipation of the pleasure to come, and a flash of white jumps out at him from the darkness beside a huge oak tree. Caught up in the vision of walking alone under that green canopy, he almost dismisses it as a trick of the light, a brief illusion. Then he remembers what he's supposed to be looking for, and he slows down and leans sideways and sees, emerging from the tangle of underbrush at the base of the oak, a rusty bullet hole and a large black letter N. Sonny swerves across the road, advances 3 inches. The N expands into N-O. He doesn't believe it, but there it is, Mouse's goddamn sign. He rolls ahead another foot, and the entire phrase comes into view. Sonny puts the bike in neutral and plants one foot on the ground. The darkness next to the oak stretches like a web to the next tree at the side of the road, which is also an oak, though not as huge. Behind him, Doc and the Kaiser cross the road and come to a halt. He ignores them and looks at Beezer and Mouse, who are already some 30 feet up the road, intently scanning the trees. "Hey!" he shouts. Beezer and Mouse do not hear him. "Hey, stop!" "You got it?" Doc calls out. "Go up to those assholes and bring them back," Sonny says. "It's here?" Doc asks, peering into the trees. "What, you think I found a body? Of course it's here." Doc speeds up, stops just behind Sonny, and stares at the woods. "Doc, you see it?" Kaiser Bill shouts, and he speeds up too. "Nope," Doc says. "You can't see it from there," Sonny tells him. "Will you please get your ass in gear and tell Beezer to come back here?" "Why don't you do it instead?" Doc says. "Because if I leave this spot, I might not ever be able to fucking find it again," Sonny says. Mouse and Beezer, now about 60 feet up the road, continue blithely on their way. "Well, I still don't see it," Doc says. Sonny sighs. "Come up alongside me." Doc walks his fat boy to a point parallel with Sonny's bike, then moves a couple of inches ahead. "There," Sonny says, pointing at the sign. Doc squints and leans over, putting his head above Sonny's handlebars. "Where? Oh, I see it now. It's all beat to hell." The top half of the sign curls over and shades the bottom half. Some antisocial lad has happened along and creased the sign with his baseball bat. His older brothers, more advanced in the ways of crime, had tried to kill it with their .22 rifles, and he was just delivering the coup de grace. "Where's the road supposed to be?" Doc asks. Sonny, who is a little troubled about this point, indicates the flat sheet of darkness to the right of the sign and extending to the next smaller oak tree. As he looks at it, the darkness loses its two-dimensionality and deepens backward like a cave, or a black hole softly punched through the air. The cave, the black hole, melts and widens into the earthen road about 5.5 feet wide that it must have been all along. "That sure as hell is it," says Kaiser Bill. "I don't know how all of us could have missed it the first time." Sonny and Doc glance at each other, realizing that the Kaiser came along too late to watch the road seem to materialize out of a black wall with the thickness of a sheet of paper. "It's kind of tricky," Sonny says. "Your eyes have to adjust," Doc says. "Okay," says Kaiser Bill. "But if you two want to argue about who tells Mouse and the bees, let me put you out of your misery." He jams his bike into gear and tears off like a World War I messenger with a hot dispatch from the front.
By now, a long way up the road, Mouse and Beezer come to a halt and look back, having apparently heard the sound of his bike.
"I guess that's it," Sonny says, with an uneasy glance at Doc. "Our eyes had to adjust."
"Couldn't be anything else."
Less convinced than they would like to be, both men let it drop in favor of watching Kaiser Bill conversing with Beezer and Mouse. The Kaiser points at Sonny and Doc, Beezer points, then Mouse points at them, and the Kaiser points again. It looks like a discussion in an extremely unevolved version of sign language. When everybody has gotten the point, Kaiser Bill spins his bike around and comes roaring back down the road with Beezer and Mouse on his tail. There is always that feeling of disorder, of misrule when Beezer is not in the lead. The Kaiser stops on the side of the narrow road. Beezer and Mouse halt beside him, and Mouse winds up stationed directly in front of the opening in the woods.
"Shouldn't have been that hard to see," Beezer says. "But there she is, anyhow. I was beginning to have my doubts, Mousy."
"Uh-huh," says Mouse. His customary manner, that of an intellectual roughneck with a playful take on the world, has lost all of its buoyancy. Beneath his biker's fair-weather sunburn, his skin looks pale and curd-like.
"I want to tell you guys the truth," Beezer says. "If Sawyer is right about this place, the creepy fuck who built it could have set up booby traps and all sorts of surprises. It was a long time ago, but if he really is the fisherman, he has more reason than ever to keep people away from his crib, so we gotta watch our backs. The best way to do that is to go in strong and go in ready. Put your weapons where you can reach him in a hurry, all right?"
Beezer opens one of his saddlebags and draws out a Colt 9mm pistol with ivory grips and a blue steel barrel. He chambers around and unlocks the safety. Under his gaze, Sonny pulls his massive .357 Magnum from his bag, Doc a Colt, identical to Beezer's, and Kaiser Bill an old S&W 38 special he has owned since the late 70s. They shove the weapons, which until this moment have seen use only on firing ranges, into the pockets of their leather jackets. Mouse, who does not own a gun, pats the various knives he has secreted in the small of his back, in the hip and front pockets of his jeans, and sheathed within both of his boots.
"Okay," Beezer says. "Anybody in there is going to hear us coming no matter what we do, and maybe already has heard us, so there's no point in being sneaky about this. I want a fast, aggressive entrance, just what you guys are good at. We can use speed to our advantage. Depending on what happens, we get as close to the house as possible."
"What if nothing happens?" asks the Kaiser. "Like, if we roll on in there and just keep going until we get to the house? I mean, I don't see any particular reason to be spooked here. Okay, something bad happened to Mouse, but, you know, doesn't mean it's going to happen all over again."
"Then we enjoy the ride," Beezer says.
"Don't you want to take a look inside?" the Kaiser asks. "He might have kids in there."
"He might be in there," Beezer tells him. "If he is, no matter what I've said to Sawyer, we're bringing him out. Alive would be better than dead, but I wouldn't mind putting him in a serious state of bad health."
He gets a rumble of approval. Mouse does not contribute to this wordless but otherwise universal agreement. He lowers his head and tightens his hands on the grips of his bike.
"Because Mouse has been here before, he goes in on point. Doc and I'll be right behind him with Sonny and the Kaiser covering our asses."
Beezer glances at them and says, "Stay about 6-8 feet back, all right?"
"Don't put Mouse on point. You have to go in first," speaks in Sonny's mind. But he says, "All right, Beez. Line up," Beezer says.
They move their bikes into the positions Beezer has specified. Anyone driving fast along Highway 35 would have to hit his brakes to avoid running into at least two beefy men on motorcycles, but the road stays empty. Everyone, including Mouse, guns his engine and prepares to move. Sonny slaps his fist against the Kaiser's and looks back at that dark tunnel into the woods. A big crow flaps onto a low-hanging branch, cocks its head, and seems to fix Sonny's eyes with its own. The crow must be looking at all of them, Sonny knows,
but he cannot shake the illusion that the crow is staring directly at him, and that its black in